Good afternoon, everyone. It is 5 minutes after 2, and it happens to be, let's see, the 15th day of November 2017, and we are opening up the House Judiciary.
And thank you very much. We're going to open up the Senate Committee on Interim Committee on Judiciary as well. Thank you, everyone, for being here. We do have a very busy schedule today. And we do know that a number of members have to get on the road before the weather gets too bad, so we're going to try to get through our agenda as quick as possible and reserving questions as necessary. Representative?
So, Whitney, you want to go over then the bills that we're looking at?
Thank you. Yes, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee. For 2008, the House Judiciary Committee has 3 bills. It's looking like one of them will be an omnibus bill dealing with record-keeping matters, such as confidentiality for certain settlement agreements. The second bill will be addressing attorney referral services through the Oregon State Bar. And the third bill will likely deal with amateur athletes and certain employment regulations. On the Senate side, there will be 3 bills as well. The first bill is looking at data breach and identity theft issues. The second bill will likely be an omnibus bill dealing with some court or criminal matters, such as PSRB arrest records. And then the third bill is still being decided on and kind of in the concept stage.
The mystery's still here.
All right, very good. Thank you. So next, members, we're going to have an overview for hit and run, that statute. And actually, Bracken McKee, if you'd come up, introduce yourself and share a little bit about where we're going. And you know, also the history of how we got to where we're at today.
Thank you, Vice Chair Olson and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you this afternoon. My name is Bracken McKee. I'm a senior deputy district attorney with the Washington County DA's office, and I've worked for Washington County for 19 years. On the night of October 20th of 2013, I was putting my own 6-year-old boy to bed when I got a major crime team call out to respond to Forest Grove. And what officers had found in Forest Grove was 2 young sisters, Anna and Abby, age 6 and 11, who were found dead in a leaf pile. Over the course of the next several hours, there was a major crime team homicide investigation and to some extent a crash reconstruction as investigators worked to learn what had happened to these 2 young girls. What we later found was that this was a complete accident, that these 2 young girls were playing in a leaf pile, and that a driver had decided to drive through the leaves, not knowing what was underneath those leaves, and had driven over these 2 young girls and killed them. But what we also found was that this driver was less than a block away, and less than 5 minutes later in time when she discovered what she had done. And because of that, I presented a case of felony hit and run to a Washington County grand jury. No crime for initially hitting and causing the death of these young girls, but a crime for failure to exchange information, to render aid, and to do all of the other things that the failure to perform the duties of the driver statute requires. And the grand jury indicted. The case went to trial. In less than 45 minutes, the jury convicted the driver of this vehicle for not doing the things that it was our understanding were required of her. What we found out from the Court of Appeals, however, is that there is a gap in the hit and run statute. And what the Court of Appeals said is that there's an obligation to remain at the scene and exchange information, render aid, and do all of the other things that the hit and run statute requires, but that there isn't a responsibility to return to the scene if you later learn that you've been involved in a crash. And specifically, what happened in my case is the driver lived right around the corner from the family. They knew they hit something. The driver's brother drove his bike around the corner and got there just as the father was calling 911 from the leaf pile with his 2 girls underneath him. And he went immediately back home. He told his sister, who was the driver of the vehicle. She took steps to hide the vehicle that night, driving past the crime scene on the way to hide the vehicle at her boyfriend's house, and later that night, returning back after midnight when all of the crime scene tape and all the investigators were still in place. The next day, they took the car through the car wash to get rid of any evidence that might be there as well. But what the Court of Appeals said is that because there was a gap in time between when the crash occurred and when the driver learned of the crash, and because she was no longer at the scene, even though she was less than a block away, that there was no obligation under the current law to return. So what we're asking this committee to address and take a look at specifically is amending the felony hit and run statute and all of the hit and run statutes to require that a driver still complete all of the obligations that they can still complete if they later learn they were involved in a crash. So on the way down this afternoon, I had a chance to talk to Susan Dieter Robinson, who's the mother of these two young girls. And she wanted me to specifically extend thanks to Vice Chair Olson for his interest in this issue, and to all of the committee for your willingness to hear about the story of Anna and Abby and address what is, I think, a gap in the statute.
So members, committee members, and then also Bracken, if you could kind of describe to the Court of Appeals opinion on this, because as you read it, it appears clearly that they've kind of opened a door for the legislature to have to act to try to kind of fix this, for what their opinion was.
So in State of Oregon versus Cynthia Garcia Cisneros, which is the Court of Appeals opinion on this case, and I might add that Department of Justice actually attempted to appeal this decision to the Supreme Court, but the Supreme Court denied review of the case. What the opinion says is that the state argues that it would leave an irrational gap in the statutory structure to relieve drivers of those duties based on a claimed lack of knowledge at the time of the accident. The state may well be right in identifying a statutory gap, but it is not our role to fill that gap for the legislature. So when I read this case, obviously I was somewhat disappointed, but to me, the Court of Appeals was asking the legislature to take a look at this and to fix what is this identified gap. You know, other cases that we thought of as examples that could fall into this issue would be the driver with a large mirror who at night accidentally hits a cyclist just with the mirror and doesn't realize that there's been a any sort of injury or potentially loss of life, and drives half a block down the road before they turn into a parking lot to take a look at their car, and at that point they can tell from the mirror that there was some sort of impact and some sort of human injury. Under the current statutory construction by the Court of Appeals, they're relieved of any obligation to return to the scene because they weren't at the scene at the time they knew of the crash.
Very good. Thank you. Any questions?
Yeah. Bracken, I know this is just a preview, so the things that we're going to be interested on the Senate side, and I think on the House side as well, is in filling the statutory gap, what is that gap? How are we going to fill it? Because your example on the second one, if someone was hit, that was hit a cyclist, and I'm not sure what on the mirror they're going to know that they actually hit a person versus hitting another mirror, and what are the gaps that are steps they're going to need to take? Because I could see where if we try to correct this, we may put a burden where I'm not sure that it can actually be filled. In the sense of where, I mean, the two examples you have given us is something very close in time to the incident and the location of where they learned of this. But if someone had drove another hour, went in to get coffee, and then they realized, I must have hit something, are we going to tell them that they then have to turn around and try to find where they were at?
So just, I know this is on the early end, but we just need to make certain that we actually are able to close the gap with some type of reality being able to be accomplished. Because as you know from your practice, that if someone hits something on the side of the road that's not a a person, that's all right, that's an unoccupied vehicle or something that's adjacent to the roadway, there is a duty to report and try to locate the owner of that property, but it's not something that they have to do immediately, at least the way I read that statute. There is a gap in time that's there, and so I just want to make certain that we, because this is going to go really quick. We're going to have one shot at this on each side, and so if we don't have it done appropriately and can't get the amendments, it's going to have to wait till 2019. So it's just a word of caution, so making certain we've got the pieces together.
Senator Przanski, I appreciate the question, and I can tell you that Dina Ryerson from Department of Justice and I have looked at statutes from several other states, and Utah actually has a statute that we believe would be helpful. And the idea is not necessarily to return to a scene in the case you've identified where there's probably not a scene to return to, but to fulfill the intent of the statute, which is to, you know, there's a goal of a public interest goal in fulfilling as many of those obligations that can reasonably be fulfilled at the time that you discover this. So if you're at fault and it's simply property damage and it's the next day, to take what steps are necessary at that point and what you could still fulfill at that point. The language that we're toying with here is if the driver has reason to believe that the driver has been involved in a collision only after leaving the scene of the collision, the driver shall immediately comply as nearly as possible with the requirements of this subsection. So, and then for going further, if there's no scene to return to, immediately call 911 and provide identifying information and the location and approximate time of the collision.
Yeah, to me, that's what I think we need to be having is some type of fallback as to notification to a proper authorities to ensure that, because what I don't want to see us getting into is having, and I don't know how the Utah case is actually played out or the law as to, well, did they fill all of the necessary gaps? Mm-hmm. They only got two of them, so, but they should have got this third one. To me, I don't want to have that gray area if we don't have to.
Certainly.
I agree.
We'll work on that for sure.
Representative Williamson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does the Utah statute have a time frame in which you have a duty to return, or is it open-ended?
It's open-ended. And I think how it's written is, you know, there's a reasonableness component when it comes to what you can do and what you should do. But, you know, you may find that there's a public interest in the at-fault driver being held responsible through insurance or otherwise, even if it were discovered 2 days later. You know, I think if there's a reasonableness component that's attached to this, there still should be some strong interest for the person at fault to ultimately be financially responsible for it.
Sure, Mr. Chair. I understand that. I just wonder about the gray areas, and again, if somebody is, the duty is to return to the scene, and somebody returns two days later.
And like we said, when there's no scene to return to, there's not going to be a requirement to return, but to simply contact 911 and provide the information that can be provided.
Representative Boyle.
You guys kind of upstaged my comment. I can't imagine that in the case of physical injury, you wouldn't have an immediately contact law enforcement requirement. In fact, I'm surprised we don't have that already in the statute. But there's a whole bunch of other things that might happen, returning, et cetera, but nothing's going to be difficult about immediately contacting law enforcement.
Thank you. Okay.
All right. Birkin, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Senator Przanski.
All right. So our next panel that we're doing on this informational hearing day is going to be the overview of the non-unanimous juries in Oregon.
We have, I believe, two individuals. Tim Callahan, come on up, and then Eliza?
Eliza.
Kaplan, please.
Yes.
I apologize for not being quite...
You're in good company.
Great. I can all use all the good company I can have.
I'm going to go first.
Okay. Chair Przanski and all Vice Chair Williamson and Thatcher. Hi, I'm Eliza Kaplan. I'm a professor at Lewis and Clark Law School. I run our criminal justice reform clinic as well. Thank you so much for your interest in this issue, which I've become somewhat obsessed with over the last 2 years, the more I've done research into it. I have a presentation, and I'm, you know, I'm also happy to answer questions along the way. I also understand from Tim that DA Josh Marquis has submitted something, which I have not seen, but I'll do my best to answer questions about that as well. Just to give you an idea, I'm sure many of you know that this issue has been brought up in the past many times. I'm not the first one to bring it up. I was reading a book about the Louisiana jury system about 2.5 years ago, and I knew that we had non-unanimous juries here, and I knew that the only other state that had it in the country was Louisiana, not exactly the best company for criminal justice, but I just sort of assumed that what I had heard and read, you know, we have this. I knew that I probably didn't agree with it because two people in a jury wouldn't have their voice heard. But then I read a little sentence in this book by a professor down in the South, and it said that Oregon's non-unanimous jury also came from discrimination at the time. And that was the first I had heard in anything I'd ever read, and anything, you know, I'd ever had a conversation about it with anybody. And I thought, I wonder what that's all about and where is he getting that? So I, along with a couple of my students, decided to dig in and learn more about where this law here in Oregon came from. And so I want to start off by giving you a little bit of the history that we learned. I wrote a Law Review article on this that was published in the University of Oregon Law Review last year. My students and I were also asked to submit a brief to the U.S. Supreme Court this last June on Oregon's, how the non-unanimous jury rule history and how it plays out in Oregon, which we did. Unfortunately, the court didn't take our case. But it did cause a lot of media attention, as some of you may have seen, and that has brought new attention to this issue. So I'll start with the article from the Oregonian, but the way I see this rule is that it was driven by overwhelming xenophobic fears sparked by a case in 1934 called State versus Silverman. And the implementation of this rule during all these years has led to a large number of felony convictions being decided by non-unanimous jury. And obviously, by doing that, and I'll get more into this, we are discounting one or two people's voices. And often, because of the demographics in Oregon, that can often be minority voices, just another added element to it. So the Silverman trial, it led to the passage of Measure 302-03, which it was passed directly after the case. The community, the media, it was a, you know, for those days, it was a big-time media event, this trial, after. Every piece of the trial was in the newspapers, from voir dire, the picking the jury, all the way to the end. And the public, because of all this media and because of this case, became outraged when 11 of the 12 jurors voted to convict Mr. Silverman, who was a Jewish man, on a charge of second-degree murder. But due to one holdout juror, they reached a compromise instead for manslaughter and a small fine. And the sole jury, basically, juror refused to support the majority views. And that led to a lot of xenophobic and racist response in the Oregonian and in the community. The Morning Oregonian editorialized, this is right out of the editorial from 1933, The reason I said 1934 case, because that's when it was on appeal, but the actual trial took place in 1933. And just to give you some of the idea of the language that the paper said, the newspaper's opinion is that the increased urbanization of American life, the natural boredom of human beings with rights once won at a great cost, and the vast immigration into America from Southern and Eastern Europe of people untrained in the jury system. And there was a lot of different things like that. As you know, at the time in Oregon, the 20s in particular, it was a time where one in four Oregonians was a member of the Ku Klux Klan. Not, you know, our best history. And this was all sort of the backdrop, even though it was the early 30s. What we saw in the early 30s is even though the KKK and membership had gone down by the early 30s, there was still a lot of attention, and there was obviously a depression going on. There was a lot of attention against people moving in from European countries, mostly Catholics and Jews and Asians also at the time coming in. So there was a lot of rhetoric, and there was a lot going on at the time of passage. Some other just little snippets from the Morning Oregonian at that time. You can see I pulled out the Americanization one, but these are, I think I included some of this in the materials I left you, but these are some of the other Morning Oregonian comments, and as you see, they're quite towards xenophobia and fear of immigration and all of that. So what happened is we ended up passing, the public ended up passing a initiative that where the people voted to amend the Constitution, and it allows non-unanimous juries. 10-2 is allowed, obviously that means 11-1. And the rule, and I'll show it to you more specifically, allows for non-unanimous juries in originally all criminal prosecutions, except for in the case of first-degree murder, which were capital cases at the time. And there is some writing at the time about how we have to keep the capital cases, the most important cases, separate from all these other ones. Those have to have unanimity. Whereas these other ones, we can use a non-unanimous jury. And interestingly, it passed with 58% of the vote, and it was a special election, and only 20% of the numbers who voted in the previous statewide election voted in this. So it passed by 58%, but it didn't have as many people voting as we would have thought. As I said earlier, we're in the great company of the state of Louisiana on this issue. Not the state I would choose to be in great company with on criminal justice, but Louisiana's law also came from discrimination, although a little different. The way it is today is unanimity, I'm not going to go into founding father stuff. I'm happy to. I'm a law professor, but I'm trying to not do that. But John Adams did explain once that it is the unanimity of the jury that preserves the rights of mankind. So there is a huge historical basis for having unanimous juries. We in Oregon had unanimous juries until the 1934 rule change, and it was in line with all the other states during that time, and it was fine. 48 states and the federal government currently use unanimous juries in criminal cases today. So that's where we stand today. And just so you know, we're not only in the company of Louisiana for having this rule, but the Louisiana rule is based in discrimination. In 1880, Louisiana passed the majority rule, allowing juries to convict without a unanimous jury. And they did it to make convictions easier to increase the convict workforce after they abolished slavery. It was formally adopted in 1898 in its constitutional convention, and I quote, to establish the supremacy of the white race. So that's the history that we're in. In 1972, the United States Supreme Court did address this issue, and I put, it's quite legal, But I put the question that was before the court, and it goes to our right to a trial jury under the Sixth Amendment, part of our Bill of Rights. And the court upheld three Oregon convictions by non-unanimous jury. It said unanimity does not materially contribute to the purpose of a trial by jury under the 14th Amendment. It did not incorporate the jury unanimity requirement into the 14th Amendment. So without going into too much, because it will get complicated, almost every single one of our Bill of Rights is incorporated to the states, meaning we follow them. We follow the federal constitution on all these different things. There's about three provisions that have not been incorporated, and non-unanimous juries is one of them. It was a crazy case where four justices came out one way, four justices came out the other way, and then Justice Powell swooped in there and changed everything. It's considered an outlier case without a majority opinion. But it ended with the court upholding non-unanimous juries in states, not federal. Okay? Just to understand, that was 1972. The court based its social science on juries of the 1950s and early 60s. So basically, they were looking at studies of all white male jurors to say, oh, this is fine, right? It actually led to tons of jury studies after this opinion, because everyone was up in arms after it came out. And now we have tons of social science on jurors from the 80s, the 90s, the 2000s, and Supreme Court jurisprudence with regard to that issue of incorporation, what we've incorporated, has changed so dramatically, especially since 2010 in a case called McDonald versus Chicago. We also, at the time in 1972, there was no information about the discriminatory history of both these laws in Louisiana and Oregon. The Supreme Court didn't even look at those things. So a lot has changed in the 40-plus years. 45 years, actually, to be exact, in the area, in the legal area, in the social science area, and we have information about these histories now as well. Non-unanimous juries in Oregon today, we dilute one or two voices. There is absolutely no doubt about that. I personally do not want my voice to not count on a jury. I can't imagine that anyone in this room would not want their voice to count in the jury room. Oregon's demographics, as I mentioned before, make this extremely extra troubling. It's actually an issue that Louisiana doesn't have. Because of our demographics, Oregon's population is 85.1% white, as probably some of you knew that already. The chances of one or two people of color being on a jury, that's about all that we're ever going to have on a jury. I watched a trial the other day. It was all white guys. And I thought, what happens if there's one or two minorities on that jury and they're the ones that don't agree? Then just by our demographics, we are not only silencing and diluting any of our voices, but we end up silencing a person of color's voice. That came up recently in a case in Multnomah County Trial Court, State versus Williams. The judge, although could not address this issue, wrote a very long opinion and actually said, and the quote is here, if one wanted to craft a system to silence the average number of non-white jurors on an Oregon jury, one could not create a more efficient system than 10-2. The other thing is that a lot of that social science I just also want to add this. As you all probably know from recent studies, is that the Oregon's criminal justice system already incarcerates black people at a higher rate than states like Mississippi and Alabama. This is from the Sentencing Project doing a study about 2 years ago. So why would we also want to add on top of that a jury system with the likelihood, just based on our demographics, that could contribute to silencing minority voices? Other things, social science, verdict versus evidence driven. We all the studies show that when you have non-unanimous juries, people will go in and say, oh, how do we vote? Oh, 10-2? Great, we're out of here, right? When you have unanimity, you are forced to have the conversations. You are forced to review all the evidence. You are forced to go through the traditional process that we all imagine that juries go through. Obviously, with non-unanimous juries, we do not have, that option does not exist. So that's a social science development that we've learned since 1972. Another issue, non-unanimous juries pressure defendants to plea. We already have 94% of the defendants in Oregon take a plea rather than a chance on a jury. And that's in line nationally. However, we are putting additional pressure on people to plea because why would they bother? You know, why would they bother? They only have to convince 10, right? And what if someone was innocent? Then their chances of proving it because are even more unlikely, or even if the state hasn't proven its case. That's what our jury system and our trial system is all about. But when 16.6% of the jury doesn't have to agree, it changes the dynamics of that. And juries should. It's why we have the jury system. It's in our history. They should have to engage with some wrestling of getting to a verdict, which does not happen in all cases where there's a non-unanimous jury system. The other thing that I think is fascinating about our rule, and this is different from Louisiana, is that, as I mentioned before, historically, we said all criminal prosecutions except capital cases, first-degree murder at the time, were subject to non-unanimous jury convictions. Today, all non-murder felony cases can be decided by 10-2, right? Where the lesser cases, the misdemeanor cases, require six jurors being unanimous to bring a conviction. So basically, we've made a choice in this state to deny in felony cases, the more serious cases, what we offer in misdemeanor cases, the less serious cases. I find that fascinating. As you've seen maybe lately, the newspapers are all across the state. This is Oregonian, in Jackson County, have been looking at this issue and all pretty much coming to the conclusion that this is something that we should be looking at and addressing. Even some of the DAs themselves, Tim can probably speak to this more than I can, but what I've seen and people I've talked to is that the DAs are a little bit split on this issue too, or at least a few of them are. DA Hummel thinks non-unanimous juries are wrong. DA Underhill has said that, you know, maybe it's time to review this law and that our criminal justice system should reflect the public shared values. And DA Marquise, I haven't read his thing, but as you know, he thinks that it's just fine the way it is. The last sort of point I want to go to is I get this question all the time. What can we do about this? So obviously the easiest thing, which you'd think is easy, would be to write a brief on the right case to the U.S. Supreme Court. Then they would take it and they would strike this down as unconstitutional. I honestly know almost no legal scholars at this point that don't believe that would happen post-2010 in McDonald versus Chicago because of the law. So forget all discriminatory intent or any of that, or even any statistics of how it plays out. Under Supreme Court jurisprudence, I don't know any scholar that doesn't think this would be ruled down. However, we cannot make the Supreme Court take this case, and people have been trying over the last couple years from both Louisiana and from Oregon. The last time was 2008, so hopefully we will continue to do that. But people say, what can we do? This is the provision pretty closely, right? As you can see, it says, however, that in the court, in the circuit court, and by the way, it starts with in all criminal prosecutions, and then it goes through a bunch of different rights, and it has a provided that, right, the 10 circuit court, 10 members of the jury may render a verdict guilty or not guilty, except for in first degree murders. So that's what it says, okay? in the way I look at it, there's a few different ways people say, what can we do? How do we get rid of this? Whatever. So the Supreme Court, obviously, is that's ongoing. Obviously, as you all know, you could refer a ballot measure, and that's really expensive and really hard and educating everybody, although it would be worthy to educate people on it. In my experience, when I tell almost anybody who isn't involved in criminal justice system that we have this rule, they literally fall off their chair and they say, what are you talking about? My law students say, what are you talking about? Because we all believe that when we go into a jury room, that it's gonna be, maybe it's based on what we see on TV, you know, 12 Angry Men or whatever, but that there is a process that a jury goes through. Where in Oregon and Louisiana, we don't have to go through that process. So obviously that's an option. Another option is to enlist district attorneys to, with their discretion, to stop using the non-unanimous jury rule. So that, as the papers here says, that is admittedly a long shot. But unfortunately, I also think it would create more inconsistency because you'd have some doing one thing and some doing another thing, and that really can create chaos and really isn't in the best interest of our system. So the third thing is a legislative fix. So I know that we're hesitant to make changes to things in our Constitution, but let's be clear. This says may. It doesn't say must. It is not a mandate. It is a may. That's first of all. Secondly, it is in our Bill of Rights. Okay, our Bill of Rights, and this is traditionally true, creates a floor, not a ceiling. Right? So we can always give more, right? We just can't go less. So if we said, oh no, let's make it eight, you only need eight jurors for a conviction, or nine, you can't do that, right? Because that would be going below what is being offered. But I argue that this is not a mandate, and it's a floor, not a ceiling. So we can legislate over it. And not only can we have already. And people don't understand that we have already. In 1947, so let's go back and look really quickly at this. In all criminal prosecutions, that's what these rules are for. Yet in 1947, we passed a law. I know none of you were on the legislature then, so I'm not going to make you explain what was happening or anything.
Olson, I think, was.
Okay. I'll let you make those jokes, right? We passed a law that said in misdemeanor cases, we're going to go six. Okay? The Supreme Court eventually in 1972 ruled on that, and then we had a ballot measure on it. We already passed a law that changed this. Okay, we already passed a law that made changes to that. We also made a law to change the non-unanimous jury provision when we included murder in general. The original provision, the measure that people voted for was for capital cases only. We decided in 1973 that it would include all murder cases. We now, and of course, let's understand this correctly, we didn't have first degree murder or what we now call aggravated murder for a while, right? Because we've gone back and forth with the death penalty. So it makes sense. But basically, this law from 1973, it was never changed to get out aggravated murder and make those only unanimous. The Oregon legislature decided in 1973 that we were going to include all types of murder, and we legislated that. So that already is taking the non-jury, the non-unanimity provision, we already have taken and made it smaller. Okay? Why can't we make it even smaller than that? We can do whatever because it is a floor, not a ceiling, and it's a may, not a mandate. We did it again in 1997 when we passed this murder law. So what I'm showing you basically is not only have we in 1947 made changes to Article 1, Section 11, We get to do that, even though it's in the Constitution. You get to do that. We've done it specifically with the non-unanimous jury rule. So the notion that this would be some radical change or that we need to study the issue forever and collect data is totally misplaced. We know that there are at least one or two voices on almost every felony criminal case that are not heard. We know that one or two of those people could be minority jurors, and with our demographics, it makes that even more awful. But what we know also is that in 48 states and the federal government, we use unanimous juries. That's what we do. We know it works fine. The question really only becomes, do we want to continue to apply a historically racist and xenophobic rule that mutes Oregonians' voices? Because now we do know the history. We didn't know it before, so all the excuses and all the issues related to it, maybe we're okay. But now we know that we're applying this rule on a daily basis. So I urge all of you to look at this more carefully. I'm happy to provide a ton more information. I can't even tell you how much I have. And help in any way to educate you on this issue. And thank you. And my Whitney has all my contacts, so thank you.
Representative Greenleck.
Phew, Tim.
Thank you. Yeah, I'd like to make a point. I think as we listen to this, we're all thinking those two voices were holding out for guilty against an innocent. I mean, I had an interesting experience of being one of the two in a 10-2 jury, and that it was a case of a charge of 80 counts of perjury against a police lieutenant, perjury before a grand jury. I happen to be one of the two holding out for guilty, and it was a 10-2 for acquittal, and I think that I was convinced I would hold out for a year if I had to, which would have clearly created probably a mistrial at that point, and eventually perhaps a new trial, which would have been more rationally decided. So it goes both ways.
It goes both ways, and mistrials and hung juries, they do happen when the jury can't agree, and that's part of our system. I mean, that is why our system is as great as it is when it's working with unanimity. Because a case where it either can't be proven or your description the other way is a case that we should move on, right? That's built into the system.
All right, just clarification. You may have covered this in your presentation. If you did, I apologize. Has the Supremes given us what the threshold, the minimum is? Is 10-2 the least that it can be?
Yeah, they have said they've said 6 unanimous or 10-2, and those were both the 1972 cases. So they're both in 1972, and as I said, there's a ton of studies on both issues since then.
So that's the 72. That was the one that was the...
Mm-hmm. I'd be happy to send you both those cases.
And then I assume that in the comparison with Louisiana, they are also a 10-2 or they're 11-1.
They actually, they are 10-2, and theirs does apply in really everything except for capital cases. Okay. So murder as well, life sentences.
No other questions. Tim, why don't you go ahead?
Thank you. Chair Przanski, co-chairs, members of the committee.
Excuse me, 1 second. Representative Stark, I missed you. It looked like you had a question. Rich?
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. In any of your research, Professor Kaplan, did you come across examples of where that, let me back up. Like Representative Greenleck, I've been on juries where I was the holdout. Mm-hmm. I've also tried a lot of jury trials. Mm-hmm. And in my experience, there are weaker jurors and stronger jurors. And did you come across any evidence that a unanimous requirement really works to prevent the weaker juror from being heard?
That's a good question. And I'm not familiar whether you were doing criminal or civil.
So
it is different, right? Because there's not a constitutional rights involved for the defendant.
There were not any unanimous requirements
under
the jury.
Exactly. Right? It's different in the civil system. You know, there is a lot of studies on juries, let's say in general, not specifically to Oregon, that have addressed what goes on in a jury room. I specifically picked out what I think is the most compelling because my time is so short here. But there's a million, I'm exaggerating, I always do, but there's dozens and dozens and dozens, let's say that, of jury studies that address all sorts of issues, including the dynamics among different types of juries in the rooms, implicit bias, a lot of this evidence, verdict-driven stuff. But no, off the top of my head, I don't know of any, and all of them result in having the unanimity, except for a couple from 1990s. All go towards having unanimity is just better in general in the criminal context.
Senator Manning.
Mr. Chair, are we going to take this up in the 2018 session?
I don't know if the Senate, our committee bills do not include this. So whether someone individually is looking at this, I think this was just kind of an overview that we are looking at. I don't know if anyone's actually looking to introduce legislation. So
I think this is a... based on the presentation that's given, it's clear that this is a serious issue. It's a serious social issue that still exists. And it is an opportunity. We say that we are full of diversity, inclusiveness, and stuff. This is an opportunity for us to move forward with the other states, the other civilized states, instead of being tied to Louisiana. And I'm sorry, I was in Louisiana. I know what it's like. So certainly I have a bill, but I'm certainly would put that bill aside to bring this bill forward.
Well, something you may want to be talking to some of the other advocates. Tim, would you like to go ahead and give your presentation? I apologize for cutting you off. I just didn't see one of the members.
No problem. Thank you, Chair Pruszynski, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Tim Colahan, Executive Director for the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I just want to start briefly by acknowledging the work that Professor Kaplan and her students and colleagues have done here. Clearly, significant time, energy, and resources have been expended in authorizing the Law Review article that has renewed interest in this policy. Unlike Professor Kaplan, I've not conducted any independent research on the history of Oregon's policy, and as a result, I'm unable to offer any significant feedback on that matter. However, my colleague, Clatsop County District Attorney Josh Marquis, who could not be here today due to a prior professional obligation out of state, has undertaken a review of the history of the policy. His analysis arrives at a dramatically different conclusion as to the origins of this law. As with any historical assessment, there are instances when reasonable people will differ in their interpretations, and this certainly is one. I know that Josh reached out to each of you earlier this week and provided his thoughts via an email. I also just let you know I did speak briefly to Professor Kaplan. I assured her I would make sure that she receives a copy of that as well. If you have any questions as to his findings, I assure you that he'd be more than happy to field either an email or a phone call, as I'm sure Professor Kaplan would as well. The history of this law obviously is important, but the policy implications of it are of more import to the district attorneys. While I may not be a historian, I am definitely a dinosaur. In that way, I can only bring to bear my experiences with this law. Having been a prosecutor for well over 30 years, and in discussing the matter with my colleagues who collectively have hundreds of years of experience, Oregon's non-unanimous jury law, while unique, is fairly applied. I was never involved in a case in which a defense attorney alleged the outcome was unjust and certainly believed no defendant was wrongfully convicted. Rather, on that mark, Oregon has an exceptional track record. The handful of cases in which a defendant was truly exonerated have almost always included the willing cooperation and often the outright insistence of the prosecutor. I can speak for every district attorney and deputy in the state when I say that one of our greatest fears is a wrongful conviction. I can also tell you with absolute certainty that the non-unanimous jury policy reduces the number of hung juries in criminal cases that go to trial. In doing so, it clearly saves scarce resources in our criminal justice system. But unquestionably, one must not put a price on justice. To this end, any criminal justice provision should never be based on resources alone, but must first and foremost ensure balance in the scales of justice. To that end, Oregon's law is uniquely two-sided. While I did not see it discussed in Professor Kaplan's article, nor have I heard it mentioned in any of the pleadings concerning Oregon's non-unanimous jury provisions, both convictions and acquittals are subject to the 10-2 rule. Yes, as you likely know by now, Oregon is the only state that allows non-unanimous jury convictions in all felony cases except first-degree homicide. While we are frequently lumped in with Louisiana, our policy is quite different, as Louisiana allows non-unanimous juries in all criminal cases, including first-degree murder and death penalty cases. What you probably did not know is that, as best as we can tell, we are also the only state in America that authorizes the accused to be acquitted by the same non-unanimous vote, and that includes murder cases. So while we cannot be convicted of murder by a non-unanimous jury, in Oregon alone, a defendant can be acquitted of murder without unanimity. This is never mentioned, probably because Oregon's prosecutors, to my knowledge, have never, ever challenged the outcome of a case so resolved. Yet it provides a balance to the scales of justice that are not present in Louisiana or any other state. Finally, the law offers another unique protection for the accused. In Oregon, a defendant can unilaterally waive the right to trial by jury and instead present his or her case to a judge. In many other states, the state can contest such a waiver. Not so in Oregon. The authors of the initiative clearly sought to design a balanced approach intended to favor neither the state nor the defendant, and if anything, offer this extra safeguard for a defendant wary of an impartial jury. This option is used regularly in courtrooms throughout the state. So while I cannot attest to the most accurate history of this law, I can attest to it reducing instances of a hung jury in cases in which a conviction or acquittal is not unanimous. It is certainly likely that if the citizens were to require unanimity, the juries would work harder to get to that consensus. It is also certain that there would be more hung juries, which would consume the time and resources of all parties in the courts. Should the legislature or the citizens of Oregon seek to change this long-standing constitutional provision, then the only course that meets the criminal justice balancing test is to wholly repeal Measure 302. Repeal the non-unanimous requirement for conviction, repeal the non-unanimous requirement for acquittal, and allow the state, on behalf of the rights of the citizens, to request cases be tried to a jury. But any such change would be made only after a careful study of the impacts. We believe such changes would result in very little, if any, changes in outcomes, but a significant increase in cost to the criminal justice system. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Al.
Well, thank you, Tim. And like Senator Manning, I think this is a very important question, but I am reluctant to demonize those that would take a position contrary to what Professor Kaplan talked about. I, too, am curious about the history that we have and what the impacts might be if we made a change. And so I'm anxious to hear more about this, but I think it's important for all of us to reserve judgment on the issue until we have a much more complete set of facts about the impacts that might be created by a change. So thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, Representative.
Other questions, comments? To both of you, thank you very, very much
thank
for being
you.
Here and presenting. And I assume this will be an ongoing topic that we'll see in the future.
Thank you.
Okay. Since Representative Olson needed to step out, let me go ahead and get our next panel started. We have this is going to be a subject matter of overview of the preliminary hearings in Multnomah County. My understanding, we're going to have three panels that are going to be coming forward. The first one is Jeff Lowe, Glenn
Yusufo, I apologize, and then Tammy Ruffing.
The compelling facts of it, too, cause them to think of the trip.
And whoever wants to start off first, I think most of you have been here before. We just need your name on the record, please.
Jeffrey Lowe, L-O-W-E.
R-U-S-S-I-N-G.
Well, identify yourself when you start speaking. That way we'll have it to the record and people know what voices with who. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Brzezanski, Vice Chair Williamson, Vice Chair Thatcher. My name is Jeffrey Lowe. I'm a Deputy District Attorney in Multnomah County. I've been there for about 18 years now. I'm here with Senior Deputy District Attorney Yuji Fusa, as well as Tammy Ruffing, a Senior Legal Assistant in our office. We're here to tell you about how it's going with the reintroduction of preliminary hearings in Multnomah County. It's been quite an undertaking. Initially, in Oregon, back in 1857, our Constitution provided only a trial by after an indictment. And that was not just for felonies, that was also for misdemeanors. But as you know, in Oregon, things change back and forth. And if you fast forward to 1973, after about five or six amendments to Article 7 of the Oregon Constitution, we ended up with preliminary hearings be one of three ways by which the district attorney's office could proceed with felony charges against a person. The first way, obviously, is still by grand jury indictment. And it appears that the Constitution is one that says that's the preferred method. The second method is by preliminary hearing, where we offer evidence in front of a court, subject to cross-examination, and then after determination by the judge of whether or not there is probable cause, that case can go forward. The third way that we can proceed on a felony charge is if the defendant makes the choice to waive his right to grand jury or a preliminary hearing. We abandoned preliminary hearings in the 1980s. Multnomah County DA's office did, as well as 34 other counties throughout this state. There's only one county currently, well, until earlier this month, one county, Washington County, that had continued a limited preliminary hearing process. There was a case called State versus Freeland that former prosecutors said this case makes it impossible for us to go forward with a policy that allows us to choose between grand jury and preliminary hearings. And based upon the reading of the law at that time, they said, we're going to go to grand jury only. And that's what we've done for the last 30-plus years, my entire career as a DA, the entire career of nearly every DA in my office. There's only two I've found that had any feeling or involvement in a preliminary hearing prior to the change in the law and our policy. But we've made a decision to go forward. In fact, we have instituted that already. Mr. Underhill has been considering this for quite some time. There is a letter that I forwarded to Ms. Perez that is written by Mr. Underhill, July 2nd of 2017. It was written to Judge Waller. And it crystallizes the view that Mr. Underhill has about preliminary hearings, about the grand jury process, about the need for justice. We are going forward with the idea that there needs to be not just transparency, but responsible transparency in the criminal justice system. We live in a time and in a place where people, our citizens, those people that are living within this state and this country are requiring greater transparency not only from government, but even DAs as well, as we proceed forward with people who are being charged with a number of serious, serious crimes. In that idea of responsible transparency, what we're concerned about is that some cases we don't think ever should go to a preliminary hearing, at least at this time, because of our concerns for vulnerable victims. Think of the 12-year-old child who is alleging that her father has done something, assaulted her, raped her, sodomized her. We don't think it might be the best case to go forward in a preliminary hearing where the defendant is sitting there 5 days after being arrested to hear evidence against him of why this case should go forward. So cases along that line, we think, should still stay within the purview of the grand jury. But we think of the 3,700 cases that we are anticipating will be going forward next year as felonies, that about 3,000 of those cases should go to preliminary hearings. It's an opportunity for greater transparency through the system, where people can sit in and watch these cases as they unfold. It is an opportunity for the defense to cross-examine witnesses,
This information will also be recorded by the court. A preliminary hearing is basically just like a mini trial. There's an opening, there's a closing, and in between there's examination of the witness and cross-examination. We're trying it out right now. We started just this 2 weeks ago in November. We had our very first preliminary hearing with Judge Ryan. We had two more earlier this week. We're ramping up slowly because we recognize this is a massive change for Multnomah County. This is a massive change for our criminal justice system, and Mr. Underhill did not want to simply walk in one day and say, let's have a preliminary hearing. He's been working with the courts. He's been working with defense counsel. He's been working with the sheriff's office. He's been working with the Department of Community Justice to make certain that we slowly move to preliminary hearings in many, many of our cases. But this movement to preliminary hearings doesn't have its own challenges. There's the challenges of court space, which Judge Waller, who I believe is going to testify in just a bit, can address. There's issues with the movement of people that are still in custody, which the sheriff's office will have an opportunity to address. There's a time for defense counsel and having a brand new type of hearing that they're going to have to prepare for and deal with. Mr. Borg, I believe, will be able to address that as well. There are massive changes within our own office, which Ms. Ruffing, who, again, is a senior legal assistant, she can speak to the, just the ins and outs of the changes for our staff as well as for our attorneys. One change that really caught me off by surprise was the idea of a preliminary hearing subpoena. It's just a piece of paper, right, that we send to someone in order to make certain that they show up for a hearing. But many, many, many weeks later, we're still finding it is a challenge for a software system that's 15 years old to adapt to something so simple as a third type of subpoena in our office. It's revealed that there are several other changes, I think, that will have to happen in our office to make certain that we continue to streamline and make more efficient our ability to get our witnesses to court each day for these hearings. Other cases that we think will remain with the grand jury are complex cases. Think of those organized retail theft cases where you have six or seven co-defendants who are stealing from seven or eight different retail stores over a period of 6 or 7 months before they're finally captured and arrested, and we file an information. That case might still best be within the hands of the grand jury. But drug delivery cases, which Mr. Ujifusa has already had his deputies doing in court, as well as auto theft cases, burglary cases, felon possession of firearm cases, those are cases that we are planning on taking forward to preliminary hearings. Our ramp up is slow. We've started in November and December with just drug cases. It's helpful that possession, for the most part, has become a misdemeanor in the state of Oregon because that took care of several hundred cases that we would have otherwise had presented to a preliminary hearing. We have far few delivery cases. But when we get to January and February, when we start getting to our felony property cases, that will become more of a taxation on the system, which we do recognize. But we are, again, are working with our partners to make certain that we can do our best each day with these matters. With regards to the issues for our staff, I really would like Ms. Ruffing to directly address this. I'm going to hand it over to her now, if that's okay.
Good afternoon, Chair Przensky, Vice Chairs, members of the committee. For the record, Tammy Ruffing, Senior Legal Assistant for the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office. Preliminary hearings is the most significant criminal justice change I've experienced in my nearly 22 years with the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office. With the phase in a preliminary hearing started, a number of new processes have been created to enable our office to successfully handle preliminary hearings. Our current case management system does not have a preliminary hearing function built into it. Our IT unit had to create new events, codes, reports, and build a new calendar for scheduling and subpoena tracking. Additionally, a new subpoena document had to be created and added in a relatively short period of time. We worked closely with court administration to implement the receipt of their new OJD court codes into our case management system, which has to be converted to track hearings for staff and attorneys. We also worked with law enforcement agencies for the new subpoena type to be accepted by their agencies. It is the best system we could create given the software limitations of all our agencies. Preliminary hearings have added steps for staff and attorneys during the screening and issuing process as well. the unit issuing staff spend more time looking for information not previously needed for the process. This slows down the timeline for our felony issuing cases. They have now to have to check the computer for more detailed information, generate more documents up front, such as restitution forms and victim rights notices in preparation for the preliminary hearing. Preliminary hearings as a legal process was not built into our case management system. Therefore, the programming which generates these documents, reports, including subpoenas, restitution notices, and victim right notifications automatically does not exist with the current case management system. Even with the work of our DAIT unit has done for the case management and tracking, staff and attorneys still have to perform workarounds to generate subpoenas for officers and civilian witnesses, run reports, and have events manually entered into our system for tracking purposes. Our office is committed to providing the same level of support to victim and witnesses as we do for grand juries and for trials. Therefore, this new administrative process has added to support staff and victim advocates' workload. Conducting preliminary hearings has added a new type of court appearance to our victim advocates' responsibility and workload also. This includes, but is not limited to, contacting victims earlier in the legal process than our current process provides. The impact is fully not known, however. It has already required changes in advocate workflow and timelines. For the felony cases, our practice is currently for our discovery unit to scan police reports into our document management system, which adds page numbers so the DAs and the defense have matching sets for use in court. Due to the one-week timeline for holding of a preliminary hearing, our issuing staff now has to make a photocopy of the police reports we initially received from law enforcement in order to provide them to defense at the initial arraignment on the felony information. This is added work to the trial unit staff. This is not the high standard of preparing and providing discovery for our office that we strive for, but it is the best solution due to the time constraints and staffing resources. Thank you. I'll hand it over back to Mr. Lowe.
We know that going forward that there are a number of unknowns. We don't know exactly if there's going to be cost savings as we go to preliminary hearings. We know that's going to be more transparent than closed-door grand jury. To remind you what a grand jury is, it's seven citizens who are selected for a period of 4 weeks to sit in a room, a private room, and to listen to evidence. Evidence that most people may never hear. We will hear it beginning in March because it's going to be recorded, but it's been in their hands for the last 170 years. So the idea of moving to the preliminary hearing is again, a big change, one that we are embracing. We think it is the right thing to do. We think it is the right thing for people in Multnomah County. We think it may be the right thing throughout the state. And we look forward to seeing how it changes the criminal justice system throughout Oregon. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Brzezinski, Vice Chair, members of the committee. I am simply here to answer any questions as I supervise.
If you'd identify yourself, please.
Of J.R. Ujifusa with the District Attorney's Office of Multnomah County. I am simply here to answer any questions you may have based on the fact that I supervise the drug unit who has started to move forward on preliminary hearings.
Okay. Sir, President,
go ahead. So I appreciate the presentation. I guess the question is, we passed a law here this last time regarding recordation of grand juries. Now Multnomah County is taking the lead of moving forward to go shifting into what was one of the two options instead of grand juries going to the preliminary hearings. It seems to me what I'm hearing now is the structuring and what it's the cost and toll it is on the office to actually shift to that. And I'm just curious as to why the office has gone to the preliminary hearing approach when all the legislation on the grand jury just required a tape recording of what was being said to the grand jury by the witnesses.
Sure. One of the unknowns is exactly how much time are those cases in grand jury going to take. It's not as simple as just turning on a tape recorder. There's a lot going on behind the scenes when you are recording testimony. I'm not a clerk. I haven't worked in that capacity through the court, but I'm a lawyer, and I have taken two trips down here to see the FTR system that the judiciary is planning on purchasing for us. And I know that we're going to entrust that recording device to a citizen off the street. And we know that it's going to take extra time to train those people. And not just train that person, but to train all of the grand jurors, because we know that grand jurors get sick, they go on vacation, they're not available. We need at least five of them at any one time to proceed in a grand jury. We think that is one aspect of time that we're concerned about. Another is people just naturally start to talk slower when we are dealing with cases that are in front of a recording. We feel that it's going to take more time. And the move to preliminary hearings isn't just spur-of-the-moment, knee-jerk reaction. This is something that Mr. Underhill has been considering for a considerable amount of time. And so he thinks that to be responsibly transparent to the people of Multnomah County, that preliminary hearings, in a lot of cases, is the right thing to do.
I appreciate that as to wanting to have the transparency, but I mean, reality, I did 2.5 years in grand jury presentations. I'm sorry, I really disagree that it's going to take any more time than having someone push a button to actually turn on the machine. Most of the individuals that I actually had come before the grand jury as witnesses as an ADA actually thought that the event was going to be recorded anyway because they watched a lot of TV. So I appreciate the perspective. I think transparency is great. I'm glad that Rod's willing to take that step to give greater transparency, but it does, from my perspective, look like a direct response to the legislature requiring grand jury proceedings to be recorded, just like they do in every other state besides Louisiana, and that use a grand jury proceeding.
Slow down.
Or yeah, federal government.
I didn't do it.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
The next panel that we're going to have up is the Honorable Nan Waller, Barbara Marcille, and David Factor. And whoever would like to go first, if you'd identify yourself.
Chair Pruszynski, co-chairs, vice chairs, and members of the committee, my name is Nan Waller. I'm the presiding judge in Multnomah County. There are some changes that we make. There are some changes that are thrust upon us. This is one of the latter. But I want to tell you that I think that the reason this is working, and probably some of what led to Mr. Underhill's decision, is the opportunity that you all gave us a number of years ago when you passed 3194 and we began a very long road of collaboration in Multnomah County. For the past 5 years, we have been meeting every Friday morning at 7 a.m. to discuss how we are going to improve our system. And it began certainly with justice reinvestment and how we will have a better, more informed decision-making process. But as new issues have come along, we have taken them on in that group and have developed the kind of relationship and trust in terms of how and an understanding of how the decisions of one part of our public safety system will impact every single other player in the public safety system. So when I received the letter from Rod Underhill in July, I wanted to make sure that this wasn't just, well, we're going to say that we're going to do prelims and then we'll see what happens with the bill, that it really was because I, knowing that it would impact the court and all of the other public safety partners considerably. So we had a lot of discussion, and I believe that based upon the work that we've done in terms of justice reinvestment and really engaging defendants and having them have better understanding, the fact that we as a court have taken on implementing the principles of procedural justice, which requires that people have a better understanding, that they have a voice in what's going on, and that they are treated with respect. The preliminary hearing process certainly fits in with that, and it gives defendants who we are trying to engage, knowing that once they are engaged and if they believe that they are being treated with respect, understand what is happening, they will accept decisions, whether they win or lose, and that they will comply with court orders. This fits with that paradigm shift in terms of moving from grand juries that are done behind closed doors and the defendant is not present, doesn't have a lawyer present, to doing this in an open courtroom with a judge there, the defendant present, with a lawyer by their side. Now, having said all of that, and so we were, once we were certain that this was a change that was going to stick so that it would support all of the changes and the ripple effects of change in our system, we got to work. We started meeting on a regular basis every 2 weeks starting in August to make sure that we understood what the ripple effects were going to be, because it was going to take more judge time, more space, more court operation time, more forms, more codes, across the way. And so when we began last week, we had a pretty good understanding of what we needed to do. And even though Mr. Lowe said that there was nobody in his office who remembered doing preliminary hearings, you're going to hear from Keith Rogers. Keith Rogers and I both remember doing preliminary hearings, which is clearly a statement about our age. But I do remember doing preliminary hearings. And as a young lawyer, it was pretty exciting to sit in a courtroom at the very beginning of a case and have the opportunity with my client right there to question the evidence that was going to be presented. And I probably remember more preliminary hearings more than for any other reason that sometimes you won at that stage, which for a criminal defense lawyer was pretty exciting to win before the case was even a week old. But we have begun. Judge Ryan, I asked him before coming down today what he would want you to know, and he said, you know, right now the preliminary hearings are kind of the bright, shiny new toy. So they're taking longer than we anticipate they will take as we're working through all of the procedural and evidentiary issues. But we anticipate that once we really get going, that we will be able to move things along. At the same time that we are implementing preliminary hearings, the Ninth Circuit issued their opinion on restraints, the use of restraints in courtroom, which added an extra challenge for us, and we have worked through that, and you'll hear from the Sheriff's Department about how they have done some reengineering of the courtroom where we are doing preliminary hearings in order to address both staffing issues and making sure that it's a safe situation and that we have the opportunity for the defendant to be sitting right by the side of their lawyer during the hearing, because it is an evidentiary hearing. When we are up and running, we anticipate that we will be running 1.5 courtrooms 5 days a week when we have all cases going through the preliminary hearing. And obviously, one of the ripple effects has been we've looked to our new courthouse, which we have built or have planned to build with 4 grand jury rooms in it, and that gives us yet again another opportunity to look and respond to the changes that we are seeing coming down the pike. I'm going to turn it over to Barb Marcel, our trial court administrator, who's going to talk a little bit about what the impact has been in terms of our staffing. I will say that we have not only at the public safety leaders circle, we have great teamwork in terms of really understanding and respecting both the mandates of each system and understanding that any change that any one of us makes is going to have an impact on all of the other systems, and we better be prepared both to help and to address those changes. But at our staff level, our staffs have all been working together in terms of making sure that we have forms that work for everyone, that we are collecting the data so that we can look at how we are doing and make the changes that are necessary.
Hi, good afternoon, Chair Przanski, Vice Chairs, members. Barbara Marcel, Trial Court Administrator for the Circuit Court in Multnomah County. I will just walk you through a little bit of the operational process for the court in terms of handling preliminary hearings. As you've heard, it's been quite a shift for us. We first needed to locate a courtroom. We didn't have a free courtroom and a half to hold this number of hearings right off the bat, so we needed to shuffle our dockets around quite a bit to make a home for these hearings. Initially, we are dedicating one morning, 5 days a week, to preliminary hearings. Only the possession of controlled substance charges are being requested for preliminary hearings by the district attorney's office at this time. That will soon move to property crimes and then to all felony case types except for those vulnerable victim crimes that the DA's office spoke about. In terms of the staffing and the planning process for this, as you've heard, just as with the district attorney's office, the court needed to determine how to track these in our case management system, what forms to use, train our staff for handling these types of hearings. These are a different beast in terms of the type of hearings that our staff are used to. They're not the short, high-volume types of hearings that we're used to handling in our criminal arraignments courtrooms, but they're also not the long, drawn-out trials that our judicial staff are used to handling. So this is somewhere in the middle, and we needed to go through quite a bit of operational planning for how to handle the evidentiary proceedings, calling of witnesses, exhibits, and so forth for these types of hearings that do need to move along fairly rapidly. What we're finding just in the first 2 weeks of having preliminary hearings is they're averaging somewhere between 30 and 50 minutes per hearing. We don't know that that's a very representative sample to be able to plan for how long these will handle, will take going forward. As Judge Waller said, we're still sort of figuring it out and getting used to the new processes. So we do expect to become a little bit more efficient as time goes on. But we also know that as some of the higher level felony cases do move through this process, there will likely be a larger number of witnesses, more exhibits presented, and so forth. So probably, you know, we're estimating the average right now may be around 30 minutes, but that really remains to be seen. Some portion of these preliminary hearings may be waived. Others are likely to take far longer than a half an hour. We are currently setting these hearings for 1 week out. So when the information of the district attorney is presented, the preliminary hearing is scheduled for 1 week from that date. That is a really short turnaround in terms of planning for release of discovery, in terms of planning for all of the additional dates that need to be scheduled for those cases. So there's just been quite an extensive amount of planning for this. We are getting quite nimble at change in the criminal side of our court. And so, as Judge Waller said, this has really been a collaborative effort in terms of working with the district attorney's office, with the sheriff's office, with our judicial department as a whole. We're sort of the guinea pigs for this process. And so a lot of the other courts in the state are looking to our court to see how it works and how long these do take and what the challenges are that we face. I'll be happy to answer any questions that you have about the process.
Thank you, Chair Pozanski, Vice Chairs, members of the committee. My name is David Factor. I'm staff counsel at the Oregon Judicial Department. Thank you again for inviting us to participate today. I want to give maybe just a little bit more of a statewide perspective, though we're here to focus on the grand, or on the preliminary hearing process in Multnomah County today as a consequence of the passage of Senate Bill 505. The legislation doesn't affect that existing authority for preliminary hearings, though we certainly were alerted during the conversation related to Senate Bill 505 that DAs were intending to reinvigorate the process related to the use of preliminary hearings. And as you heard, the use of preliminary hearings fell out of favor 30-some years ago, and while some folks still recall that, since that time, district attorneys have almost exclusively used the grand jury proceedings to initiate their cases and bring indictments in felony cases. So I do think it's fair to say that Senate Bill 505 did cause DAs to reevaluate the use of their preliminary hearings in that process. The OJD, from a central standpoint, has been working with all of our courts across the state and with the community partners in our three early adopter courts for grand jury recording, Multnomah, Jackson, and Deschutes, to designate the purchase, to identify and designate the, and purchase the equipment to be used for recording, and also to develop, as Ms. Marcille was saying, the business and case management processes, including data processing codes, for protective order and preliminary hearings to ensure that we can have consistency throughout our courts and certainly to comply with the requirement in the legislation that we report back to the body on the impact of the legislation, on the impact of the return to preliminary hearings in late December of 2018 and again in January of 2019 on the eve of the session. As you heard, the decision on whether how to proceed with the case is a choice made by the district attorney in each jurisdiction. And grand jury recordings begin in the three early adopter courts March 1 of 2018. The anticipated use of preliminary hearings in those three counties is illustrates sort of how that choice will be different across the states. We anticipate, and what you heard was in Multnomah County, They seem to think up to 85% of their cases will move to preliminary hearing rather than proceed by grand jury. In Jackson County, they anticipate moving up to 25% of their cases to preliminary hearing, and the rest will remain in grand jury. And in Deschutes, the elected district attorney there does not intend to move any cases to preliminary hearing to keep them all in the grand jury proceeding. In the other counties that begin recording in 2019, almost all of them plan to move at least 50% of their cases from grand jury to preliminary hearing, which could mean for courts across the state up to an additional 20,000 scheduled hearings statewide. And so we do expect that the processes and experiences in Multnomah County, our largest circuit court, to help us inform and influence the choices that we need to make sure that we can handle that volume and making resources, the physical and staff and judicial resources available to courts in order to manage the change, the significant change to the use of preliminary hearings. I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Any questions? Senator.
So just want to follow up. My understanding is Washington County actually, at least the DA's office, I thought was using preliminary hearings as a stepping stone for maybe just for drug cases. I'm not sure what subject matters they're limiting it to. I understand that what happens at that time is that it's scheduled, but then they make an offer at the time of just prior to the actual hearing happening, and a lot of the cases get settled. I'm wondering if you have had any opportunity to look at their court, how that's actually worked, and have you gotten any feel as to the time it's taking or what adverse or positive impacts it's had?
All I was going to say is that we are aware of their process. We don't think it's really informative as to what our process will be, particularly because of the justice reinvestment process that we're going through. We are trying to move towards better informed decision making, and so having assessments and judicial settlement conferences is an important part of settling the majority of our felony cases. Our intention is not to allow the preliminary hearing to be an incentive to fast-track a case and avoid that process. So that's our goal.
Okay.
Chair Brzezinski, as a follow-up on that, we certainly want to make sure that we are giving people the opportunity, because we have all agreed across the public safety system that we will not use this as an opportunity to bypass the justice reinvestment, since many of these cases are going to be justice reinvestment eligible for Multnomah County. But we will have release hearings at the preliminary hearing, at the hearing, so that we can get people out of custody, and that won't be the pressure, which I think is oftentimes when you are making a fast deal. The pressure is, and you're going to get out of custody if you take the deal now and you waive the preliminary hearing. So we wanted to avoid that, which is why we moved up the possibility of having a release hearing to the preliminary hearing.
Thank you.
Representative Williamson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dave, where are you in selecting equipment for recording? Someone mentioned the FTR system earlier, right. And is that where we've landed? Where are we in the procurement process?
Chair Brzezinski, Vice Chair Williamson, members. We have investigated equipment. We have invited the staff and the district attorneys from the three pilot counties to come and see a demonstration of the FTR, what they call their One Touch product. And we're in the process of making a recommendation to the Chief Justice to designate that as the equipment to be used, and then we'll move into purchasing. And our hope is to deliver the product to the recording equipment to the pilot counties in January.
Can we get clarification that this One Touch, is this a different system than what the court's using? If it is, Dave, give us a little bit more understanding, because my understanding is that they do have systems that are pretty much is truly One Touch.
The Chair Brzezinski members, the equipment that we intend to purchase for use for the grand jury recording is the software is the same software as what's used in the FTR product that we use in the courts to record. But the interface for the person who's doing the recording is on and off.
High tech.
So, Barbara, I suspect that you were probably preparing for recording in the grand jury environment?
We were selecting the equipment for recording. We were not planning to do the recording. The bill requires that a grand juror does the recording.
Okay, so David, your agency was preparing for this.
The Senate Bill 505 requires that the Chief Justice designate the equipment to be used and purchase the equipment, and obligates the district attorney to ensure that a grand juror records the proceedings in the grand jury. So no, there is no court staff in the grand jury room, never has been, and Senate Bill 505 maintains that as the status. But it gave the OJD the obligation to purchase the equipment. We did a demonstration with those early adopter courts so they could see what it was we were thinking about using. And we'll be proceeding with the purchase agreement on that.
Okay, I'm trying to get a handle on Senate Bill 505 from your perspective, from your ground level.
Sure.
Barbara was just testifying that somewhere between 30 to 50 minutes, they're hoping to get down to 30 minutes for prelims.
Yes.
What was the average that had you even considered that for what it would be involved in for the time involved with recording?
Chair Pozanski, Vice Chair Olson, I think you might get a better answer from someone from the District Attorney's Office who's in the room doing grand jury proceedings about how long they take rather than from me. If I had to get a wild guess, and you probably see from the nods or the whatever in the behind me, that on a routine possession of a controlled substance case, you're talking 15 minutes or less in a grand jury proceeding, one witness, a police officer, one witness. It gets longer the more witnesses you have to call.
Sure.
for those matters.
Okay, thank you.
Just a comment. I mean, the reality, instead of having a grand juror designated to take handwritten notes, they're going to be designated to push buttons on and off and when the witnesses are there.
And
so that should be pretty quick.
The provider of the equipment, they can prepare templates for you so that it'll be easy log notes, witness one, witness two, insert the name, that kind of thing. So there's just a way to go back and find, which we'll need later when we're dealing with the protective order proceedings that come up as a result of the recording of the grand jury proceedings.
So actually it would be better than the handwritten notes that are currently there, because we don't have access to them and we don't know what the grand jury is writing down in their summaries.
Okay, good. Very good, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so Keith Rogers, Lane Borg, and Captain Chad, is it Gallegos?
Gallegos.
Okay, thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Pozanski, Vice Chairs, and members of the committee. My name is Keith Rogers. I'm a lawyer. I'm the director of MDI at Multnomah County Public Defender Office, one of two. Mr. Borg is the other director in Portland. And as Judge Waller noted, I have the distinction of having, by being old, I have the distinction of having done about, I'd say, 300 or 400 preliminary hearings before the district attorney decided to change the system. So I know a lot about them. I still think of Judge Waller as the new young lawyer in the office, so that says something. I think it's pretty clear that the new system is going to be more difficult for the courts and the defense providers, because there are just more resources required, more money required, more time at the front end that will take a lot of hustle. But I don't see them as bad. I think that they are... I applaud the transparency argument. I think that everything is even more transparent than a recording from the grand jury. And it's amazing how quickly things resolve when you play poker with all your cards on the table in the first week of the case. You see the witnesses, you know what the weaknesses are, the DA sees the defendant, maybe has a completely different take on who they are and where they're coming from. And I think there's a real opportunity there to utilize these for the better, to move more quickly. Just like justice reinvestment, I think that the defense providers will be putting a lot of energy and resources into this, and the system will hopefully be the one that benefits and the citizens and the other parties as well. So I think it's actually could be a good thing if it's done right. I also practiced in Washington County for 20 years, so I know how their system works. And it's a completely different system than what is anticipated in Multnomah County. It's really not a very, it's not really very complete because they rely on hearsay evidence and they require that the prelims be waived most of the time if you want to keep a plea offer open. And so they don't really take place there. So I'm hopeful Multnomah counties will do better. Just an aside, for speaking of being old, just so you know that all of those Perry Mason episodes, those were all preliminary hearings. So I think they will take a lot less time in Multnomah County, but that gives you an idea of what this is really all about. And we're optimistic we can make it work best for everybody. So.
Representative Greenlee.
Mr. Rogers, let me ask you and perhaps Mr. Borg can comment as well. I understand this has been a difficult budget year, and your new contract is pretty skinny. Are you worried about the effect on manpower and on your budget that this adds?
We are. It's a sort of, we're having a flat budget. We're not really getting any increases over the next 2 years while our costs go up. But as usual, we'll muddle along, but it is a concern.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair, Vice Chairs, members of the committee. My name is Lane Borg. I'm the Executive Director of Metropolitan Public Defenders in Multnomah County and Washington County. Washington County, as you've heard, is one of the counties that has always done preliminary hearings. I don't disagree with much of what Keith just presented to you in terms of what the hope and expectations are. I guess let me talk a little bit about some of the fears or concerns that may creep into this. Now, what Judge Waller said is absolutely true, because in Multnomah County, we never miss an opportunity to hold a meeting. And so this is at 7 a.m. And we are endeavoring to collaborate and to get as much into that, utilize that appearance as well as possible. But the fact of the matter is that the standard, the question before the judge at a preliminary hearing is significantly less than what is at almost any other type of hearing that happens in the system. It's essentially, is there probable cause to believe that the case is going to move forward? I was talking to some of my lawyers in Washington County this morning. I think that I'm not trying to be too glib about this, but their heads might explode at hearing what we're doing in Multnomah County. I watched the first preliminary hearing. It was 35 minutes long. It was essentially a car stop with some methamphetamine that had been packaged. And, it was a pretty simple DCS Boyd delivery case. And I think in Washington County it would have taken 10 minutes or less at the preliminary hearing, because what's happening out there is the judges will just say, once they've heard enough evidence for probable cause, they'll just go, done. You know, they don't want to hear anything more. We're done. We're moving forward, and the case has happened. So I think there's a lot of hopes and aspirations. I don't know that we'll be able to keep up that resiliency. I don't know whether that's a terrible thing if that ends up happening. I don't know if it's going to change the outcome that way. But this is way too early to really know what that impact is going to be. We've got a couple weeks in and half a dozen preliminary hearings done. What it absolutely is doing, and this speaks to a little bit to what Keith was saying, is that historically, when you wait for a grand jury, the defense really gets in and this is not a good thing, but they get in a kind of, we're just going to wait. We're going to wait and see what happens. There's not a lot for us to do. We've got a week till the grand jury gets back, maybe, 4 or 5 weeks before we have to actually appear in court and do something meaningful. And this is turning that on its head. This means you have to be ready to go in a week with have some kind of meaningful response, or at least prepare for that, because things can have consequences at a preliminary hearing. We are hearing that there's an intention to perhaps use, this really won't apply in drug cases, but I think will apply in property cases and maybe even domestic violence or other cases down the line, that there may be an attempt to use testimony at grand jury, I mean at preliminary hearing, to substitute for testimony at trial. And that's going to be a very complex issue that comes up, because you need to have, we would need to have full cross-examination, full discovery, all those things. And that's going to be completely contrary to the expeditious way in which preliminary hearings are going to evolve to. Now, I'm not trying to be pessimistic about that, but I think we're going to evolve to a much more expeditious, a faster system where judges, once they hear that they've got probable cause, they're ready to move on and we're done with this here. But it is requiring that they, in this getting on it right now, it means that we're having to do a lot more coordination around who's assigned. We are endeavoring to have it be unified representation, so the lawyer who's assigned at arraignment is the lawyer who then does the preliminary hearing and then has that continuity with the client. I think that will aid in what Mr. Rogers was saying about having confidence, and what Judge Waller was saying about having that confidence with the client that they've gotten some kind of meaningful interaction with their attorney and evaluation of the case. I hope we don't go to the waiver issue that Washington County has done. Typically what happens, Chair Przensky, as you were mentioning, they don't make you plead to it there. They will make you an offer, and the offer then is contingent upon waiving the grand jury. They'll let you sort it out maybe later on at the pretrial conference or something. But the mechanism is not necessarily to manipulate the plea right there, but it's to say this plea is off the table unless you waive your right to preliminary hearing. And that has a distorting effect, because the offer may or may not have any right relationship to what is a good offer or not, but we have to advise the client about that, and then clients get worried that, well, will that be off the table? They don't know what the future is going to have, and so more often than not, they waive the preliminary hearing. So I will be hopeful, like Mr. Rogers, that this all does not evolve down to, I don't think we'll get as where Washington County is at, but I do think we're going to be ending up in a much faster system than what we're doing right now. And what it means, other than we have to get on it, I don't really know, and I'm not drawing conclusions other than we have to get out there and get on it within 5 business days.
Capital.
Good afternoon, Chair Przensky, vice chairs, members of the committee. My name is Chad Guidis, and I'm the captain overseeing the court services unit for the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office. As part of this afternoon's comprehensive overview of Multnomah County's new preliminary hearing process, I'm here to provide you details from a public safety perspective. MCSO has worked alongside the partners here today through the aforementioned meetings to ensure preliminary hearings could be safely implemented at the courthouse located inside the Justice Center in downtown Portland. We credit this collaboration with the development of a safe, accessible process for everyone participating in these hearings. In an effort to conduct preliminary hearings using the least amount of staff resource and defendant restraints necessary to maintain order, MCSO completed a capital improvement project which provided a see-through barrier between the courtroom and the gallery, as well as additional emergency alarm functions to prevent an escape during in-custody matters. The cost of this project, in conjunction with the estimated increase in the numbers of hours a deputy must be present, will require additional costs to be incurred by MCSO in 2018. This consists of the construction costs and the additional funds needed to fill deputy positions based upon the increase in court hours projected by the District Attorney's Office. Because the staff costs are not budgeted funds, they must be calculated at an overtime rate. In the 2 weeks preliminary hearings have been conducted, we've had a relatively small number of court matters, which are only on a morning docket. This was part of an intentional ramp-up designed by this group to provide sufficient opportunity to adapt our process if necessary before committing to a full-day docket. We are confident we will be able to manage the increased workload created by the expanded preliminary hearing dockets in 2018. We're pleased to be an integral part of this collaborative and to assist in the facilitation of preliminary hearings in Multnomah County. Thank you for the opportunity to be a part of today's testimony. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Any questions? Okay, thank you very much.
So our next informational hearing is on the implementation of the medical marijuana regulations, specifically dealing with House Bill 2198. We have 4 presenters today, and I guess what we'll do is let's pull up the first 2, which would be Anthony Taylor and Lorianne Carey.
I think Anthony's on the outside. You want me to go see if I can find him for you?
Lorianne,
yes.
When you're ready, give us your name and go ahead. You can start your testimony.
Okay.
We'll get Anthony to join us.
Excellent. Good afternoon, Chair Przonski and members of the committee. My name is Lorianne Carey, and I live in Josephine County, Oregon. I'm the secretary and co-founder of a domestic nonprofit that's the Oregon Sun Growers Guild. We advocate for sun-grown medicinal cannabis and patients' rights. I've been a certified organic farmer in Josephine County for over 25 years, growing everything from fresh produce to vegetable and flower seed, and also numerous other medicinal plants. I'm also a registered clinical herbalist, and I grow other medicinal plants besides cannabis to use in my clinic. We started growing cannabis about 10 years ago for the OMMP when patients who were in need approached us because of our expertise in sustainable and organic growing. We grow for 10 patients, and I'm currently one of them. We value our grower-patient relationship because these are people in need of specific varieties of cannabis. For instance, my patient who was hit by a City of Eugene bus needs THC-rich strains for her pain relief, whereas my patient with Asperger's syndrome and skin tumors needs CBD-rich strains for his medicine. I had reconstructive hand surgery 2 years ago. 4 days after my surgery, I was off the opioids and used topical cannabis for pain relief. Hello, Anthony. For severe pain issues, complex regional pain syndrome. Normally, that would require a lifetime of opioids and gabapentin, and I can report that I'm 100% pain-free due to using cannabis topically. We never ask our patients for money, most of whom are on disability. 51% of Oregon's medical marijuana patients are on disability. We appreciate being able to take our limited access to dispensaries, and we also appreciate helping other patients with our quality medicine. Last year, my farm was inspected by the OHA. I was proud to show our beautiful farm and healthy sun-grown plants. We had a cordial meeting, and we even discussed cannabis science. We talked about terpenes, and terpenes are compounds in cannabis that are found in household plants like basil, lavender, mango. So we walked around the garden smelling plants and had a wonderful, cordial visit. My patient and grower cards were in line, and I passed my inspection. This year, I was very surprised when I received a letter in the mail that I would be again investigated. The investigators were unfriendly and, I believe, purposefully intimidating. I received substantially less than the 24 hours minimum required notice. The investigators arrived in a black SUV with opaqued-out windows 30 minutes earlier than the agreed-upon time, and they became pretty irate with me when I said, I'll meet you at the appropriate time and not any sooner. I had to ask for their IDs individually because they were not forthcoming with those at the outset. Last year, the inspectors were polite, friendly, and happy to show me their badges. Although I had contained my dogs in a very large diesel farm truck, I was required to list them as a hazard. My husband was not allowed to speak, and neither was the co-investigator. When I asked to copy the paperwork that I was being forced to sign or fail the inspection and be fined, I was told I was not allowed to copy the paperwork. I've since been informed that the OHA have carbon copies now that the investigators will give the growers, the paperwork the growers have to sign. I had two less plants. The plants were unhealthy. We removed them. Then I have grower cards for. When it came time to reconcile the plant count, I was informed that under House Bill 2198, since I was my own grower who also grows for other patients at my grow site, I would be subject to a 12-plant limit. This has been nerve-wracking for growers who, like me, were compliant up until this change in interpretation was announced late this summer. I rushed to meet with my attorney
who informed me that I could designate my 22-year-old daughter, who's also a cardholder due to a severe car accident, as my grower, and I could be her grower. Although we have always been our own growers, this was not allowed due to the new interpretation and effective immediately. This was long after we had renewed our patient and grower cards. I had the OHA change form and certified mail receipt on hand to show that I had come into compliance with these confusing and fairly overzealous interpretations. The investigators then attempted to reconcile my grower cards with their records. They had four less patients on their roster and looked at my cards with surprise. After a private conversation between the two investigators, I was again passed. The entire investigation this year was completely different in tone and comportment than last year's inspection. There's now, thankfully, a temporary waiver until January 1st associated with the change form filing. I haven't received the money in return that I sent in to become compliant, and nor have other growers who were forced to file this change before the waiver of fees was enacted. I thank you for listening to my story of the uncomfortable interrogation-like investigation. This leads me to the crux of the issue, which is overzealous interpretation of House Bill 2198 by the Oregon Health Authority. The federal government, even under the Bush administration, never told the state of Oregon to clamp down on its successful medical program. We serve thousands of Oregon's most destitute and vulnerable patients. Adult use cannabis lawmaking was, according to the Oregon voters pamphlet, not to affect the Oregon medical marijuana program. This is what voters believed when and if they voted for Measure 91. I know that's what I believed. The Oregon medical marijuana program is in jeopardy as we speak. The Oregon Health Authority has failed in its responsibility to medical cannabis patients, especially concerning the 12-plant rule when growing for yourself and other patients. This was not the legislative intent of House Bill 2198. When the December 1st medical marijuana grow site election forms are tallied, the potential is for at least 29% or 30 to 40,000 of Oregon's most destitute and necessary patients not having access to their philanthropic medicine. This is a humanitarian crisis of epic proportion. I live in Josephine County, where the Board of County Commissioners intend to pass prohibitive ordinances that will eliminate over 80% of our 3,000 growers. And these are in addition to the state's mandate. Those numbers have yet to be taken into account. There's going to be the need for legislative fixes to this abysmal situation for thousands of Oregon's medical marijuana patients for years to come. In the immediate future, for early 2018, I would ask that the legislature eliminate the 12-plant limit, which penalizes growers for also being patients. Another solution would be to eliminate the need for every grower at a grow site reporting into Metric. METRC is the acronym for the seed-to-sale tracking system. Allow one grow site administrator to report for the site. Thereby, it will reduce the number of new growers having, therefore they won't bog down the system. Also removing the 4 patient per card per grower cap would allow growers in the metric system to embrace serving multiple patients, again reducing the strain on the new system by reducing the number of growers and therefore providing medicine for those thousands of patients who will have no grower or access to the medicine they need. I encourage a delay in the effective date of July 1st for OMMP growers to move to the end of December. A rolling admission open in July but ending in December will not be in the middle of the growing season, which is a strange time to begin metric reporting, and it will also give the agencies more time to assess the situation and have more time to implement the new program. This will give growers incentive to join, knowing they will have more time to comply. And as a professional grower, I am also asking that the 24-inch definition of a plant being subject to reporting 2-to-1 ratio to immature plants be removed. This will first of all be in line with what current OLCC growers are allowed, which is unlimited immature plants. Immature plants are not psychoactive. I will not go into too many details here, but suffice it to say that as a grower who starts with seeds, not clones, the plants most of the time are not even viable as a female plant. Marijuana is dioecious, meaning there are male and female plants. We only plant the female plants. A plant is barely determined at less than 24, at over 24 inches. So not, it also reduces our ability to cull from a large amount of genetic diversity, which reduces diversity and vigor in the genetics we have bred and nurtured in a lot of cases for decades. I also think the state should be more clearly define reasonable time, place, and manner. Local restrictions are above and beyond the state's intent. Josephine County is just one example of local lawmakers taking advantage of this lack of clear boundaries from the state and virtually eliminating all but the biggest commercial grows on resource lands. And then to tie this all in, I believe the OHA investigators should have OMMP growers, both indoor and sun growers, make presentations to them so that in their training they can be more effective to what they will find in the field. Therefore, there will be more mutual respect and understanding of what all the parties can expect when these investigations continue. I'd like to congratulate my colleague Anthony Taylor here of Compassionate Oregon for his appointment this morning to the Oregon Cannabis Commission. His appointment and confirmation, excuse me. The commission will have their hands full attempting to find opportunities for solution to the impending crisis to many thousands of Oregon's medical cannabis patients. I look forward to working with Anthony, other members of the commission, the OHA, the OLCC, and the legislature. And I thank you very much for your time and consideration today, and I'm happy to take any questions you may have. Thank you.
Let's go ahead and take the presentation from Anthony, then we'll just open up for questions.
Good afternoon, Chair Przanski, Vice Chair Olson, members of the Judiciary Committees. My name is Anthony Taylor, and I am president of Compassionate Oregon, a nonprofit organization advocating for Oregon's medical cannabis patients since 2013, and the originator of the concept behind House Bill 2198. I've been asked here today to provide an update on House Bill 2198, some of the unexpected costs and barriers we are accounting, and what might be done to address some of these issues. After languishing under the guidance of the Oregon Health Authority for nearly two decades, House Bill 2198's primary goal was to create a different administrative structure for the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program, which would not only create a bright line between the medical and recreational structures, but would also appropriately responsive to the needs of the patients, have accountability to the legislature through a biennial report on the status of the program, and to work with other agencies and organizations to propose legislative concepts to address these and other issues facing Oregonians using cannabis. House Bill 2198 created the Oregon Cannabis Commission, whose nine-member panel will now be responsible for guiding the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program into its future. House Bill 2198 also created these following provisions: redefined plant growth, plant limits, allowed OMMP grow sites to be identified using tax ID and tax slot IDs and GPS coordinates, reinstated caregivers' ability to grow, prohibited high security measures as a condition of reporting into the cannabis tracking system, allowed dispensaries to be located within 500 feet of a school under certain conditions, and allowed OMMP grow sites to transfer up to 20 pounds per year into the OLCC regulated market. As you can see, it's a lot of things that it added. But you can't talk about 2198 without talking about Senate Bill 1057, because this is where the tracking mandate and the new plant limits originated. 2198, after creating the Oregon Cannabis Commission, became more of the fix to the fix. And Senate Bill 1057 was primarily intended to be a technical fix bill for OLCC and move quickly through the building becoming law in early May, but it also made changes to the OMMP that would have an enormous impact on its patients and growers and their economic success. So as it left to House Bill 2198, still making its way through the building to make some corrections to 1057, adopt provisions to address issues that had manifested during the session, and try to minimize the economic impact those changes might have on our patients and growers. The two most significant provisions in Senate Bill 1057 that affected the OMMP patients the most were a 10-plant limit on all households in Oregon. So the Senate Bill 1057 took the 4-plant limit for all households in Oregon for recreational and applied that to medical and said you can only grow 6 medical. And then it mandated seed-to-sale tracking for OMMP grow sites with more than 12 plants. This new household limit, and Lorianne touched on this also, was really the first to create an unexpected issue. House Bill 2198 amended 1057 to reinstate the household limit to allow a husband and wife to be able to continue to grow the 6 plant statute allows, but the committee would not allow the 4 additional recreational plants set forth under Measure 91 to be grown. The resulting section in House Bill 2198 to address this created some confusion and resulted in OHA receiving counsel that led to the following determination. HB 2198 creates a new grow site compliance issue where patients growing for themselves at their own home would no longer be able to grow for others, and the grow site would be capped at 12 plants. This became known amongst the community as the 12-plant rule. Considering the majority of all OMMP grow sites are configured in this manner, meaning a patient can grow for 4 others, and the very foundation of Oregon's medical program is built upon the concept that that patients can grow for others unable to grow for themselves, the interpretation was confusing and sent shockwaves through the OMMP grower community. Growers facing harvest season had to hurriedly reconfigure grow sites to become compliant or be subject to a civil penalty and plant quarantines from OHA inspectors who at the time were conducting grow site inspections in several areas around the state. The cost of reconfiguring a grow site under this change is $300 for each resident patient at the address growing for themselves. This change required thousands of grow sites to reconfigure. OHA did not initially notify OMMP growers of this change until after it was discovered in late September through on-the-ground conversations with compliance officers, and eventually worked its way back through channels that the growers' community was noticeably concerned in seeking answers. On October 5th, OHA issued Informational Bulletin 2017-08 notifying all growers of this change, and October 27th issued Informational Bulletin 09 adopting an emergency temporary rule effective, as Lori indicated earlier, till January 1st to waive the change in grow site registration fees for those OMMP grow sites that needed reconfiguration. They have also temporarily suspended, as Lori said, grow site inspections until further clarification can be reached and a new policy can be established. This conversation is ongoing. It really is penalizing growers. I mean, patience for being growers, this interpretation, and it's had a huge impact on people. So the second issue affecting the OMMP community is again tied to Senate Bill 1057 under the new tracking mandates. Under the tracking mandate of Senate Bill 1057, an OMMP grow site with more than 12 plants must switch from monthly tracking system used by OHA to the tracking system used by OLCC licensees known as metric system. To this end, the OLCC felt it necessary to determine and prepare for new metric users coming into their system, and Senate Bill 1057 required the OHA to send out a form by September 1st, 2017 to all growers required to come into metric, notifying OMMP growers that they must return the enclosed grow site election form by December 1st of this year, and notifying OHA of one of 3 choices for the grow site. OHA growers growing more than 12 plants had, growing for patients had to decide to remain with the OMMP and enter into the metric tracking system, growing more than 12 plants, remain with the OHA, growing 12 plants or less and avoid tracking altogether under the exemption, or transition into OLCC and submit your application to do that by January 1st, 2018. A grow site that did not return or does not return this form will not be allowed to renew the grow site, and patients will not be allowed to renew at that grow site either.
Anthony, I need you to start wrapping up. We have another part of this presentation plus another panel.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So really all these changes have had enormous impact on the cost it's going to take to grow for patients. It's just for growth site registration fees and metric user fees alone to grow for eight patients is going to cost a grower $2,600. And a lot of these growers are taking care of the doctor's visit costs and the card costs for their patients. So it can be a pretty good chunk of change to get all these people into the system. So through all this, you can look through the rest of my testimony in the slides. What I would recommend as a fix is, one, clarify HB 2198 section 11 to reflect legislative intent. While the fix was easy and fees were waived, it is this type of arbitrary rule that has such huge unforeseen consequences on patients and growers, and, as I said, penalizes patients for being growers. Remove the remaining barriers to multi-patient grow sites and consolidate grow site reporting into the responsibility of one person. If we don't go grow site specific regarding reporting into metric, it's going to just completely muddle up the system. You're going to have to bring 10 to 14,000 new users into the metric system, and it's going to be a lot of problems. So also, as Lori mentioned, we can remove that limit of four patients per card. If a person that's responsible for a grow site right now is allowed to grow 24 plants, it doesn't seem like it's that much of a big leap to go to 48 plants, which is the limit, plant limit, for most of these gardens. I would also suggest that we waive that administrative cost fee for the first year until it really gets decided on how much is going to be due. And then the metric mandate, as mentioned before, move that deadline for complete compliance out to December 31st of 2018 and allow OMMP growers to roll into metric as they renew their grow site. So in conclusion, I'd just like to add that many of us are excited about and looking forward to Oregon's new Cannabis Commission and the opportunity it will provide to work through these and other issues cannabis patients face on a daily basis. It will be especially nice to be able to discuss these issues without the overarching conversation around recreational regulatory structure. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions?
I just follow up. Thanks, Mr. Chair. Yeah. So, Anthony, the 20-pound rule for being able to grow that from a medical perspective and then be selling it or giving it to LCC. How does that seem to be working? And the second thing is, how do I explain to somebody that says, are you paying attention to what's going on with I-80 through Nebraska right now with all the stops that they're making and all this marijuana? You know, it just seems like, wow, something's going on here.
Chair Przanski, Vice Chair Olson. Yeah, the 20-pound rule was an attempt to bring some of the product being produced by the medical growers into the regulated system because of the rapidly evaporating OHA grow sites here, which is their only access to market.
Dispensaries,
I'm sorry. Now we're down to 21 dispensaries, and it makes that job even harder, and some of these dispensaries have their own product that they put in, so it's a big issue. And I just have to say that diversion is an issue, and we have to do what we can to minimize that diversion. But until the country legalizes cannabis nationwide, it's going to continue to go on. And only after the country legalizes nationwide will this diversion become legal commerce. Then we can start dealing with the other states that opt out or whatever might happen.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, and Representative Olson, what I heard from OLCC, because I had a conversation with them on Monday, I don't know if they've checked in with you.
Never.
But they've also said that that situation that was in Nebraska, they're looking at that under investigation right now as to what type of license they had or where they think it actually came, because it may have been a completely illegal location of where that product was coming from. So they're still trying to figure that out as well. But that's, I think, the issue is that when you do have a lot of individuals that have been growing illegally, how do you embrace them to come into a system and stuff? Thank you all very much. We'll go to our next panel. Shannon, why don't you come on up? And Lillian?
Chair Brzezanski, Vice Chairs, members of the committee, my name is Shannon O'Fallon. I'm a Senior Assistant Attorney General with the Oregon Department of Justice, and I've been advising the Public Health Division and the Medical Marijuana Program since about 2005. With me is Lillian Shirley, who is the Public Health Director of the Oregon Health Authority. I'm going to do sort of an overview of the Medical Marijuana Act, really, or Medical Marijuana Program, really briefly for those of you that might not be as familiar. I think that Anthony already hit the parts, you know, sort of the highlights of House Bill 2198, so I'm not going to go through those, and then Lillian's going to talk a little bit about grow site inspections in that process. So, of course, the Medical Marijuana Program is administered by the Oregon Health Authority, and OHA registers patients, and then patients can designate caregivers, and they can grow themselves, they can designate a third-party grower, they could decide they're only going to get their marijuana from dispensaries, and so then OHA would register both caregivers, their growers, and the grow sites where marijuana is being grown. OHA registers dispensaries and processing sites. So if you want to, on the medical side, if you want to be able to sell marijuana to patients and caregivers, you have to be registered with the Oregon Health Authority. Marijuana, of course, is not taxed at dispensaries. Medical patients can also get their medical products from an OLCC licensed retailer as well. And again, those products at an OLCC retailer are tax-free. Processing, if you want to make a cannabinoid product or concentrate, or if you want to make an extract, which is something that's made with high heat and pressure, that's sort of considered more dangerous. On the OHA side, you have to be registered by the Oregon Health Authority. If you're making extracts, you can't be in a residential zone. And House Bill 2198 did adopt a provision that allows caregivers to make products, cannabinoid products, and concentrates without being registered, so they can provide that service to patients as well without needing any sort of a registration. And then for growers or grow sites, as I said, if patients are going to designate themselves or a third party to grow for them, they have to register that grower, they have to register the grow site. Growers can grow for up to 4 patients, and then the grow sites themselves have plant limits, but there's no particular limit on the number of growers that can be at a grow site. So I just thought, we thought that these statistics might be a little bit interesting. You can see sort of since OLCC's licensing kicked into place, a pretty dramatic drop in the number of OHA registered dispensaries. There were quite a few applications for processing sites at one time, but then again, when OLCC licensure went into place, most of the processors decided to go over to the OLCC side. You haven't seen quite as dramatic a drop in number of patients, caregivers, and growers. Again, I think I'm going to pretty much skip over the House Bill 2198 highlights. I was going to also talk about the 20-pound transfer. So this is from a grow site to an OLCC-licensed wholesaler or processor. Those transfers do have to be tracked in OLCC's seed-to-sale system, and you have to have been registered with OHA on or before the effective date of House Bill 218 to be eligible to make that sort of transfer. I think it's also true on the OLCC side that they can sort of halt those transfers if they feel like there's too much product on their side. Again, Anthony went over the changes in the grow site limits. The most dramatic changes were in regards to a grow site where it's a patient's residence and a patient or their caregiver is growing there, a sort of a hard cap of 12 mature plants. and then that includes any recreational plants. And then you can see, you know, if you're in a city, in an area that's zoned residential, you have certain plant limits. If you're inside the city but not in a residential zone, you're outside the city, you have different plant limits. You can be at a grandfathered grow site, so if you were growing for the Oregon Health Authority at a grow site on December 31st, 2014 and were continuously registered at that location, then you can qualify to be grandfathered. There were new plant limits that went into effect in 2198 for immature plants, but that's only for immature plants that are over 24 inches in height. So if they're under that height, there's still an unlimited number of immature plants that are allowed. All right, and so with that, I would also say that there were a number of other marijuana-related bills that were passed this last session, and so OHA has some draft rulemaking out there right now. Those draft rules are open for public comment until December 1st, 2015. Yeah. 2017. Yes, what year am I in? All right, and with that, I'll hand it over to Lillian.
That's my cue. Chair Brzezinski and members of the committee, as Janet said, I'm Lillian Shirley, and the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program is in the Oregon Health Authority and the Public Health Division, of which I'm the director. Oregon Health Authority was given explicit authority to conduct on-site grow inspections in 2015 in House Bill 3400 for medical marijuana growers. Compliance staff focused on dispensaries and processor registrations and inspections from December of 2015 through October of 2016. The priority was to register and inspect dispensaries and processors, since this was a whole new business that needed to be stood up and understood in terms of what the impact was on the community as well as the people involved in the industry. We had 446 dispensary applications we processed in 2016 and 322 processing site applications in 2016. And part of the reason there was that gap and so many was because there was a gap of 15 months when the OLCC was not registering. So those people came through our system at the time. So we were able to serve the dispensary and processes for the businesses, and then we began inspections on the grow sites as we were charged. So in October of 2016, we conducted 14 inspections, and the purpose of that was to gain an understanding of the outdoor sites and to have growers assist us in developing what our inspection processes should be. We developed the grow site inspection procedures and processes actually over an 8-month period between January and August of 2017, and OHA conducted various stakeholders, including legislators, law enforcement, most particularly the state police, land use officials, Oregon OSHA, grower organizations, and the OLCC in developing those procedures. So compliance staff began routine inspections, as you heard, in September of 2017. That was just a couple months ago, applying the new plant limits that were put into effect in House Bill 2198. We did post the plant limit chart on our website to explain the changes in House Bill 2198 on September 6th of 2017. The law went into effect August 2nd, and we were waiting to get guidance from the Department of Justice, so that was the delay between that and the end of August, and then we had Labor Day weekend, and the following week we were able to implement that. Once that happened, we quickly realized that our medical registrants, which includes our patients, our caregivers, and our growers, needed additional communications about the new plant limits and how it pertained to them. And this was through a feedback process where we received complaints. The compliance inspections were halted, as you heard, in mid-September. Letters were mailed to all patients. I don't know the number. It was given to you by Anthony of the bill, communication. But we did send out over 5,000 caregiver letters and growers explaining the changes. So we've resumed inspections with two core goals. One was to educate the growers on the changes in the law. And secondly, if locations were out of compliance with the new limits, a grower has 60 days to comply with the new laws. There were two citations given for locations out of compliance with 2198, but these were both rescinded, and the staff were instructed in the future to only educate and not give citations because of the changes, as you heard, were quite disruptive and rather all-encompassing. So just to finish, we continue to refine and adapt the inspections process, input from our grower feedback, our legislature, and our OHA leadership. We will work toward continuous improvement, and we will continue to be open to changes that make the inspection process clearer and successful for both OHA and the grower population. Recent changes that we have made to the process for improving it include: we will provide copies of all documents to the grow site representative. We will make sure to contact the grower between 24 and 30 hours before arriving at the grow site. The staff will notify management if there is any management being, you know, OHA management, if there were any future issues, and the matter will be forwarded to OHA leadership within 24 hours. And we're having new business cards made up for the compliance specialist in the field, which will include an ombudsman email address to use if the grower has any concerns about the inspection or the inspection process. And the ombudsman is outside of the medical marijuana program. It's independent from the program itself. And in 2 weeks, that will be live. So, again, members of the committee and Chair Przanski, our goal is to ensure compliance with Oregon laws and to support Oregon's medical marijuana system in these changing times.
All right. Thank you. First, I want to compliment and thank Patrick Allen and the whole crew as to being responsive when these issues came to me, and I had the meeting with them to implement some of the stuff that you've done. I will say that as a member on the joint committee, that I was somewhat surprised that we had immediate enforcement on a plant level in the middle of a growing season, actually right at the time of harvesting, when you have patients had already contracted with growers, because it has in fact caused a lot of concerns. And I understand that maybe we didn't need to have rule making procedures for that, but the reality, it seems to me that there was no intention, at least, and I've got at least one member from the committee here, that we thought that this was going to have an adverse impact in the middle of a growing season on the impact on patients. Are there any other questions or comments?
Congratulations to Anthony for the appointment.
Yes, thank you. Thank you all very much for coming forward. So we have one last panel. Good representative.
Okay. Yep. Thank you, Senator. And the last panel is Amy Joyce, Tracy Pearl, and Sergeant Todd Mokin would come up. And while they're coming up, I want to also recognize Representative Power for being part of us now. And welcome.
Thank you. Chair Przanski, Vice Chair Olson, Vice Chair Thatcher, and members of the committee, I'm Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation, today representing our Transportation Safety Division. And our panel was asked to come forward and talk about the implementation of House Bill 2597, which is the updated distracted driving law that was passed during the 2017 session and went into effect just this October 1st. I'm going to start out with just a little bit of sort of background to where this bill came from and some of the safety issues that sort of brought it forward. So after years and years of decline in fatalities on the state highways, where we had gotten to a point of the number of fatals on our state highways were the lowest since the 1940s, and the rate of fatalities, that's number of fatalities per 100 million miles of VMT, the rate of fatalities was the lowest in Oregon's history as of 2013. However, sometime after that, we started to see fatalities increasing and increasing significantly. And that fatality rate was not all explained by the increase in VMT, or vehicles miles traveled, that one sees with an increasing economy and that sort of thing. But VMT increase did not explain all of the fatalities by anything close. We did a presentation in Senate Transportation in 2015 showing some of those increases, and remarkable was the number of lane and roadway departure fatalities with really no explanation, not impairment, not speed, not weather. And the sort of hypothesis was that a lot of these are likely due to distraction. In 2016, ODOT commissioned Southern Oregon University to do a study of distracted driving, to do a survey. And that survey found that 75% of respondents admitted to driving distracted while alone, 44% admitted to driving distracted when they had passengers, and yet 84% felt very uncomfortable when they were a passenger that had a driver who was distracted. In 2015, also, there was a Court of Appeals opinion regarding the prior distracted driving law, and that very much narrowed and really tied the hands of law enforcement in terms of how they could enforce the distracted driving law. And therefore, in 2016, ODOT, Oregon State Police, and AAA jointly formed a task force to look at what we could do about distracted driving. Representative Olson was a member of that, Senator Courtney was a member of that, and coming out of one of the recommendations was to update the distracted driving law, which you all are quite familiar with from the session. So just as a backdrop as to one of the some of the important reasons that law needed to be changed.
Hello, my name is Tracy Pearl. I'm the manager of the Highway Safety Section for the ODOT Transportation Safety Division. You normally see Troy Costales here, but he's not here today. So I work with Troy very closely. I'm here just to touch on three aspects, the outreach and education that has been conducted by ODOT to date on this new law, some of the issues and questions that have come in from the public on interpretation or questions about this law, and then the distracted driving aversion course that is an option for courts on a first offense. So in regards to outreach and education, first there was a paid media campaign run statewide from through September and October on that included radio ads about the new law. Did you know October 1, put it down. There was also some bus tails and side bus, they call them King ads, in Regions 3 and Region 4 of ODOT, and there was Facebook ads statewide as well. In addition, there was the variable messaging signs that ODOT has above the highway, snow ahead, that type of thing. Those had a really quick message the week before and the week after the law became effective October 1st saying law changes, put your phone down. Of course, we didn't want that message to be very distracting, so it was very short. All but one of the required highway signage that was in the bill has been put up. Statewide, there's one remaining in Region 5 that to talk about the possible criminal penalty on a third offense and raised fines. There have been, ODOT Communications also came out with a Drive Healthy campaign. It's a software app that they're promoting with a vendor called Lifesaver, where we wanted to have, from the task force report, they wanted to have a positive impact instead of always, you know, negative, you're going to get a ticket, blah, blah, blah. They also wanted to say, let's give you credit for not using, holding, answering your phone while you're driving, and it allows you to gain points for not picking up your phone, and you can join a team, and it's a competition, and so that's being piloted right now. We don't have a lot of results, but there are a lot of teams participating, including ODOT employees. In addition, we also had, I'm not sure if you're familiar with the Lexus Thermwanger crash back in February 2016. We've had a couple of campaigns where she was a young girl that was on her cell phone while she was driving, and she veered out of her lane into an oncoming and seriously injured two other people, and she was killed. And her the car that she was in, which is, of course, very atrocious, has been in a display with her story, and we did a tour around the state through all the regions where it was for a month here and a month there, where it could be shown at high school assemblies or the local police agencies or AAA. Whoever wanted to utilize that for education could do so, and it is still out there being used for those purposes. two more items on outreach and education. We also created a one-page summation for the public. It's on the website, on the distracted driving webpage. What, you know, basically these are the bullet points of it. The other side is the same bullet points, but more specifics for law enforcement and the courts. And lastly, the Oregon State Police did conduct some high visibility enforcement of the existing distracted driving law since April, which is National Distracted Driving Month, through September, and giving warnings and such to say the law's changing, you're not going to be able to hold it anymore, and that kind of thing. So as far as outreach and education, those are the things we've done. Ask ODOT has gotten a lot of questions from the public, primarily on if what I do is okay. The main two issues that we've been asked about are I use my GPS, and I always have it in my cup holder, or I have it on the seat next to me, or I have it on holder on my dashboard. I put in my address before I leave my driveway. Is that okay if I'm not touching it while I'm driving? And the answer is yes, you're not touching it while you're driving. The other question that has come up is regarding the one swipe rule or the one touch allowance that is in there to activate or deactivate a function of the device. There's some concerns about the question of, is that for, if it's just for one trip, is that, what if I'm only in my car 10 minutes driving across town, or I'm on a five-hour trip to, you know, Eastern Oregon? Am I still only allowed that one swipe or that one touch? That's a question that we haven't been able to answer at this point, but that is a question that's come up. Another primary question has been the look back on convictions. There are increased penalties for subsequent offenses. The third offense, if convicted, results in a misdemeanor. So the question has been, is it third conviction plus one? Does the look back start, is it retroactive to if I had this offense to the same law, 811.507, before October 1? Or does my first tracking start on October 1? And that has gotten some differing judicial opinions on that. The other, there's several more on, excuse me. For the first offense, the court can elect to waive part or all of the fine for the offender if they want them to, and if they agree to go to a distracted driving avoidance course that was built into HB 2597. The court can waive part or all of that fine, but the conviction must remain on their record because of that first or second or subsequent offenses. And so that has been a little bit confusing as to, if I go to the class, why do I still have the conviction on my record? The other issue is utility truck exemptions. That is an exemption in the current law, the new law. We get a lot of questions on the definition of a utility truck. Primarily, I believe this came from testimony with the utility companies, gas, water, electric, but we're getting calls from garbage and recycling companies, cable companies, pretty variety of, that use a large truck, wanting to know the definition of utility truck because they use two-way keyed mic radios or communications while they're driving those vehicles. So that definition is not there, but our answers to that have been it's utilities as defined, water, electric, heat. Not as much, but a slight question has come in regards to the commercial motor vehicles. They do have an exemption allowed to use the mobile electronic devices per 49 U.S.C. 31136, which is federal motor carrier standards that require them to, log all of what they're doing, and they now have electronic logging devices that they can use. Now, obviously, they can still log before and after and not during their driving, but if it is permissible under that federal standard for the commercial motor vehicle driver, that exemption stands. Lastly, type of electronic devices. our two-way radios exempt, our CBs exempt, our keyed mics exempt. The answers that we've been giving, and of course I want to tell you, we preempt all of our answers with, we're not attorneys, but this is how the bill reads. And the exemption includes any installed device that is UHF, VHF, uses family bands plus CBs. Those are allowed for use and are exempt. So those are the primary issues that questions that ODOT and others have gotten about the new bill, primarily from the public, but also those utility truck drivers and such. Lastly, in regard to the distracted driving aversion course, ODOT Transportation Safety Division was tasked with, we are to provide the list of approved providers for that course to the courts by January 1 of 2018. The temporary rule for development of that course has been developed and will go before the OTC this Friday, their November 17th meeting, and we're banking on approval. We've already developed the application form for providers and that process, and I do want you to know that the OAR Advisory Committee that developed that temporary rule included potential providers, existing providers, the courts, and law enforcement representatives, so that all parties affected would be there to help make those rules. Is there any questions for me?
We'll go ahead and take deputies.
Thank you, Chair.
Sergeant.
Chair Brzezinski and members of the Judiciary Committee, my name is Todd Mokin. I'm a sergeant with the Marion County Sheriff's Office. I'm here representing the Oregon Sheriff's Office Association, the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police, to discuss issues connected with the initial period of enforcement of a House Bill 2597, the new mobile electronic device. As a background, I'm a sergeant in charge of the Marion County Sheriff's Office Traffic Safety Team and crash reconstruction and scene homicide team. I've been a police officer for over 22 years, spent several years as a motor deputy and almost 10 years as a narcotics detective, conducting numerous investigations into motor vehicle crashes with my crash team, focusing on criminal investigations. I'm an active committee member with the ODOT Law Enforcement Traffic Safety Advisory Committee, and also was on the ODOT Distracted Driving Committee. Preparation for today's testimony, I reached out to a group of law enforcement partners to get their feedback. The agencies include Oregon State Police, Woodburn Police Department, Kaiser Police Department, and the Washington County Sheriff's Office. Some of the comments that was stated back to me from the officers on the streets were, I had a guy on an e-reader on Highway 217 at 1700 hours, rush hour on a Friday, just reading away and not looking up for about 3 seconds at a time. He was swiping pages with his finger. One of the other officers, I'm still seeing people playing on their phones while stopped at traffic lights, and they have a green light, and they don't start moving until somebody behind them honks their horn. Our folks are encountering the same issues you described, head constantly looking down, face illuminated in the evening hours by the light of the device. Here are some key early enforcement observations. The law is allowing law enforcement to enforce the law as the driving behaviors identified in House Bill 2597. When the device is in your hand, we don't have to prove that you're actually communicating. We just know that you're actually doing something with the device. Officers are still seeing lots of people holding their devices while leaving and entering parking lots, the premises open to the public, which is a violation of the law. Officers are seeing more persons hiding or looking down at their devices and phones. Often, they are checking their area around them before doing so to see if any law enforcement is present. The effectiveness of the distracted driving avoidance course that will be in place in January is uncertain because the violation remains on the driver's record if they successfully complete the course. The question is whether drivers will have sufficient incentive to go through the time and cost of taking the course in order to get possible suspension, and that it still states on their record, and of course the third conviction being an actual misdemeanor within 10 years. Drivers may just decide to pay the fine as opposed to pursuing the distracted driving avoidance course is what we actually wanted them to do. Continuing public education regarding the new law is important. An education outreach effort directed at rental car companies is in order due to the number of out-of-state drivers who are renting cars and not aware of our Oregon laws. Educating drivers regarding the potential impact to their auto insurance rates for multiple mobile electronic device citations may be an effective messaging. The fact is that at some point, insurance companies are not going to like seeing that on your record. The Oregon Department of Transportation is allowing the use of overtime enforcement funds that are typically used for seatbelt enforcement to be utilized for distracted driving enforcement. With a statewide seatbelt compliance rate of 98%, use of this enforcement dollars for distracted driving enforcement is smart and strategic. I'm available for any questions.
Representative Boyle.
Thank you. I'm still really troubled by this. When we look at Section 2 of the law that says a person commits the offense while using a mobile electronic device, while operating, while driving a motor vehicle on a highway or premises open to the public, which could mean a parking lot, a public parking lot. I get that. But it basically says holds the mobile electronic device in the person's hand, and that's, we know what that means, or uses a mobile electronic device for any purpose. Now, it does provide an exception, and this is where I want to go to your observation that it's one swipe per trip. This, I just can't imagine that we're going to end up with folks with felonies, or excuse me, misdemeanors on their record who've swiped that thing like I did five times between Shoals and the Capitol this morning to answer the phone. I tapped it at least five times because I got at least five phone calls. So I guess I'm asking, are we being reasonable in our enforcement? And it really is somebody's got the phone in their hand, or obviously they've got it on their dash and they're reading the newspaper on it, and not we're looking to bust people who are using it in ways that are reasonable.
Go ahead.
Chair Brzezinski? Yeah. Absolutely, I think we're being reasonable. My interpretation, 22 years in law enforcement, would be the fact that the one swipe is to activate or deactivate the phone. So if somebody's calling you in, I know you have to, somehow you have to turn the phone on for the Bluetooth. The fact is that that's just one swipe. If you do it later on down the road, I think you could be able to do another swipe. I don't think that would be an issue. And also the fact is that we're not going to follow you down the road for 5 hours.
Well, of course not. Follow up. Here. So let me give you the other one that I'm hearing about from a lot of colleagues, and that is the fact that I've got a new car. It's got a built-in screen. I get in the car, I plug my phone in, it sits down in a place and I never even look at that phone. But I can pull up a podcast, I can read a text message. All of that, NHTSA has decided in its infinite wisdom back in D.C. that safety feature in the car is adequate. So I'm doing a whole bunch of things. And I think that still is okay when it says deactivates a mobile electronic device or a function of the device. Once again, I'm asking the question. Obviously, if you're swiping to read something, that's a distraction. But if you're initiating a podcast or you're initiating a text message that you got an alert came up and you're reading it eyes up, on your dash, what's our position?
Chair Brzezinski and the committee, that's legal. It's mounted, installed inside your vehicle.
Okay.
It's not inside your hand. Absolutely.
Well, I wanted to put that on the record because I think that's really important for people to know, and I think it's important for ODOT when we get the questions to be careful about giving the impression that kind of activity is prohibited under the new law.
Just clarification,
go ahead.
That's hands-free device. You know, that's the exception I think you're really describing on the swiping stuff.
Well, it's not truly hands-free, unfortunately.
If you're holding your hand,
right,
it's in your hand. It's not hands-free. And that's where I think a lot of people have gotten confused as to when you read it. I think maybe it could have been written better, but I think it's written fine based on our work on it. Mm-hmm. The one that's come up to me is the Apple Watches.
and stuff like that. Is that because it's not in the hands?
It's on your wrist.
And so, you know, there's more, let's say, opportunities to be giving clarification.
If I may, Chair Przanski, and this goes to Representative Viles' question as well. I mean, certainly, you know, folks, unfortunately, folks call ODOT and give a detailed fact pattern and say, is this legal or is it? How many, well, can I wait 10, you know, 3 seconds between dialing a phone, you know? And these are the kinds of questions we have to deal with. So I assure you, Representative Vile, we're not telling people that in a five-hour trip, no, you get one swipe and you're done. You know, there's an element of there's common sense. There's an element of the officer isn't going to follow you for 5 hours. There's an element of the courts are going to have to deal with some of this stuff. Folks are going to get tickets or any probable cause for a stop for DUI or whatever it is. And the courts will wrestle with interpreting some of this stuff. And certainly it doesn't outlaw all distractions. I don't think anybody claims that it does, but these are the kinds of questions we're dealing with over at ODOT when people call Tracy and ask exactly what they can and cannot do.
Right. Any other questions?
Mr. Chair, I'd simply like to thank the panel for their persistence in waiting to be the last.
Yes, thank you very much.
I do have a process question here. I think we... If I remember correctly, and I don't remember what came through on the House side, but didn't we have some sort of law where we were going to track sort of demographics of people pulled over and the reasons they were pulled over? And I'm wondering if this will fold into that.
That's the profiling bill.
And does this work with that? In other words, will we get some sort of information on demographics?
Oh, okay, so you're talking about 2355 versus where we're at right now with this. Now, there wouldn't be... That'd be entirely different.
Seems to be saying yes.
Oh, we do have legal counsel in the room. Since the question has come up, you'll be so kind as to come up and just put something on the record so we can close the loop on that.
Chair, if I may, I would like to add to the interest would be, almost what zip codes are we seeing this propensity for distracted driving with regard to cell phone usage?
That's something that I would think ODOT may actually be able to give you based on citations and locations. Josh?
Josh Nasby, for the record. trying to use my device to pull up the text of the bill as we speak. My recollection, and we had a conversation in the back of the room, is that it applies to all traffic stops, so it would be a violation stop. So I think the profiling, the data would have to be entered for the stop.
I think that'd be interesting to look at after some time.
Senator Thatcher, now my recollection is they will also denote the reason for the stop, so I suspect we can pull that out.
Yellow. All right. That's it. Oh. Representative Ron Noble, are you interested in coming up and sharing your concept? Negative. You want to stay covert on this? It's your call. Well, just really quick. You got 1 minute. That's it. We got people hungry here.
Understand. Thank you. Ron Noble, State Representative for District 24, Chair and Vice Chairs in the committee. One issue that I'm working on actually deals with exemptions to the law. And after harvest this year and seeing four or five combines going down the road and some wide loads, it came to my attention through the Farm Bureau that there is no way right now, as the law is written, that we understand, for those farmers to coordinate safe travel over roads, tight corners, and bridges without violating the law. So we're working on something very narrow that allows wide loads and safe transportation for large vehicles, including combines and other vehicles, but with a real narrow focus to ensure that it's safe. And with that, that's about my minute.
Okay. Thank you. Yep, there's a vial.
Sorry. So, Ron, have we had people actually getting violated for using their cell phone driving the tractor or combine down the road already?
Not that it's been brought to my attention. The concern is just farmers who want to obey the law and looking for a way to actually safely do so, move their equipment.
I think it's my recollection, and something I heard from the Farm Bureau, that they formerly had an affirmative defense to distracted driving that was dropped out of this bill, and so this is
approach that way.
That'd be correct.
That's what I was going to say. I thought that's what it was thinking.
You just want to clarify it a little bit more on that.
Correct.
For implement of husbandry type operation.
Well, the exemption for ag vehicles was taken out of the bill. I mean,
right.
It no longer is in the current bill.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And with that, the House Committee on Judiciary is adjourned.
And the Senate Committee on Judiciary is also adjourned. Thank you very much. Senate Committee on Judiciary is also adjourned. Thank you very much.